Call the Commerce and Labor Committee meeting to order. I'm going to defer to the Chair Atkins for a few seconds to kind of give us a roadmap for the day, and then you can maybe send it back to me and we'll bring your bill up.
You got it.
Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we get underway with respect to the bill, the game plan for today is we've got the nuclear waste storage bill that's up first. We're going to talk about that for a little while, and then we'll have once we get through the testimony there, and we've got some very distinguished folks here to testify with respect to that bill, as well as folks from Xcel Energy. Once we've done that, we're going to take a little bit of a break and come back with three drug-related or pharmaceutical-related bills this afternoon. So there will be a little bit of a break in between, and I invite you all back. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to turn it back to you, and we can pick up the bill.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Any questions before we move into this? Seeing none, Chair Atkins, to House File 2440.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if you all had a garbage man that didn't show up for 28 years, would you continue to pay the bill? That's as crazy as it sounds. That's what this bill is about with respect to nuclear waste storage. In 1982, the federal government promised that it would find a permanent storage facility for nuclear waste. Since that time, over several hundred tons of nuclear waste have been accumulated here in Minnesota with no place for it to go. The storage facility, the permanent storage facility, was supposed to have been done in 1998. It is now 10 years overdue, and all of that temporary storage, or is temporarily stored waste in Minnesota, continues to sit on the shores of the Mississippi in Red Wing and Monticello with nowhere to go. 10 days ago, Stephen Chu, who is the U.S. Energy Secretary, said that the one option, Yucca Mountain, the one option that was set up for permanent storage of nuclear waste is now no longer an option. It is entirely off the table. Secretary Chu went on to say that that waste may remain in temporary sites for another 50 years or more. What we're up against here in Minnesota is a situation where we need to come to terms with what we're doing with respect to storing spent nuclear waste, radioactive waste. And it's about time that we stepped up and had that discussion about what we're going to do with it from a public safety standpoint and from the standpoint of the fact that we continue to pay $1 million a month to the federal government to find a permanent storage site. And they have nothing to show for it. The federal government is literally at square one. They will admit to you that they are at square one as far as finding a storage facility on a national level for a permanent location for spent nuclear waste. As a result, it continues to sit, literally hundreds of tons of nuclear waste continues to sit along the Mississippi River here in Minnesota with nowhere to go, in casks that within 5 years will be beyond their warranty period. Let me say that once more. We've got casks in which hundreds of tons of nuclear waste are stored temporarily that will be beyond their warranty period in 5 years. At the same time, additional casks have been authorized by the Public Utilities Commission for further storage of hundreds of tons of radioactive nuclear waste. And I'm sitting here, I will come back and talk about the specifics of the bill, but when you have the distinguished sorts of folks that we have joining me at the table here today, I think you ought to hear from them, because they are literally, when we talk about the waste that's being stored, it's literally right out at their curb. When I took my garbage out this morning and dragged it down to the curb, I had an expectation that the garbage man is going to come today. If I were to take it out 28 years in a row and the garbage man never came, it might be time to rethink that and exactly what we're doing with respect to storing nuclear waste. So I want you to hear from some of the folks for whom this nuclear waste is literally out at the curb. They're the ones who are having to babysit it and figure out what to do with it. So with that, I will turn it over. I don't know exactly what order, but I have the city council member from Red Wing, I have the mayor of Monticello, and I have the tribal chair from the Prairie Island Indian community. And I think maybe what we'll do is, I'm sorry, Representative Hoppe.
Representative Hoppe.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, or Mr. Chair, I've got a quick federal government question. Can I ask that now, or do you want me to wait till the end?
Chair Atkins.
My hope, quite frankly, was to get the testimony done and then come back, and we'd all, I think, be happy to stand for whatever questions you may have.
Perhaps on the agenda, we have Mr. Herbst, the mayor. Do you want him to go first, or do you want the council member to?
We are in Russell before, if you want.
Okay. Ms. Bailey, please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready.
Lisa Bailey, it's B-A-Y-L-E-Y. Good morning, Representative Atkins and other members of the commission. Thank you very much for inviting us here to speak today. My name is Lisa Bailey. I'm a city council member of the city of Red Wing. And I want to first start out by noting that the storage and protection of nuclear waste is an essential and incredibly important issue for the city of Red Wing. It's so important that we're moving forward on this despite having one of the toughest budget situations in Red Wing history, despite operating at staffing levels that haven't been seen in our city since the 1970s. Politically, it would be much easier for us to just ignore this problem, but we just don't have that luxury. If we don't make some decisions now, we as a community and as a state, this problem isn't going to go away. Spent nuclear fuel is the most toxic substance on Earth. With the recent closure of Yucca Mountain and the complete failure of our federal government to make good on its promise to take that waste, Minnesota must be prepared to deal with the spent nuclear fuel that's piling up in Red Wing and Monticello. The numbers are just staggering. After Prairie Island and Monticello are decommissioned, the two plants, there will be 5 million pounds of spent nuclear fuel sitting in Red Wing and 2.6 million pounds sitting just north of the Twin Cities and Monticello. And just to be clear, that's 2,450 tons of nuclear waste just in the city of Red Wing. All of this waste is within 50 miles of 3 million people and will likely be sitting at the headwaters of the Mississippi River for possibly centuries to come. The city of Red Wing supports and has always supported the presence and operation of the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant. And we hope to work with Xcel on possibly developing some strategies for dealing with this long-term solution. But at the moment, the city of Red Wing is not prepared to become the de facto storage facility for that nuclear waste. And we are very worried about what this means for the long-term health and viability for our community. We're worried and concerned that everyone seems to think that someone else is going to deal with this problem. In the meantime, more waste is being generated every day. We need a plan to deal with the storage and the protection of that waste. From the city's perspective, we can't guarantee that we have an adequate fire and EMS response capability for the Prairie Island today, much less to ensure that those same services are going to be available for 40, 50, 60, possibly 100 years from now. For those reasons, the city of Red Wing thinks it's absolutely essential that Minnesota push the federal government to accept responsibility for that waste, as they are already obligated to do, but as they have failed to do. We need to speed up the federal government's response, and our only real leverage right now is that Minnesota ratepayers are paying a nuclear waste fee. For that reason, City of Red Wing supports Representative Atkins' House File 2440 100%. By cutting off Minnesota ratepayer funds for Yucca Mountain, this legislation sends a clear signal to the federal government that the Minnesota ratepayer tap is closed. By redirecting the ratepayer funds to the Minnesota Nuclear Waste Escrow account, this bill is setting up a funding source that Minnesotans will be able to access if the federal government doesn't pick up that waste. These funds are going to be usable to ensure long-term planning, monitoring, planning and monitoring, and that fire and EMS services are available if an incident should occur. In other words, these expenses are not covered by Xcel's decommissioning fund as it stands now. Red Wing also supports the establishment of the Nuclear Waste Commission in Minnesota. Minnesota must have a state-level institution whose charge is to be responsible for planning, monitoring, and preparing for the de facto permanent storage in-state, because, let's be honest, that's what this is becoming. Host communities must be actively involved, and that's why we're very glad to see that Representative Atkins has given all of us, and you'll hear from the other representatives, that has given us all an opportunity to be included as equal members of the commission. Finally, the legislation also specifically allocates resources to the local communities, and that is essential. Here's what Red Wing would choose to do with those resources. We would start to implement the requirements of our recent fire and EMS master plan. And the requirements of that plan, we are completely unable to fulfill those right now as it stands. We will plan for how the city will monitor and protect the long-term, protect the waste that's out there already and what will be there when the plan is decommissioned. Finally, I open by noting that I'm a member of the City Council of Red Wing. I'm also the mother of two, and I'm a long-term, hopefully, obviously long-term resident and community member of the City of Red Wing. And I speak as such to say that Minnesota must realize that we are going to be storing spent nuclear waste in our state for decades or possibly generations to come. It's critical that Minnesota have an immediate plan that addresses the enormous responsibility of both housing and protecting nuclear waste in our state. I'd be happy to take questions at the end if we want to go on.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Chair Atkins?
I think if we can hear from the chair of the Prairie Island Indian Community, and then we'll go upriver to Monticello.
Okay. Chair Winfrey?
Yes.
Okay.
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Victoria Winfrey, and I am president of the Prairie Island Indian Community Tribal Council. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I would like to thank the bill's author, Chairman Atkins, for his sincere interest in the impact of nuclear waste on our community. The Prairie Island Indian Community is among the closest communities in the nation to a nuclear power plant and its above-ground nuclear waste storage site. The plant's twin nuclear reactors and 27 large cement nuclear waste storage caps currently sits just 600 yards from our homes. Since it went online in 1973, Xcel Energy's Prairie Island Nuclear Power Plant has been a major concern in our community members with respect to safety, health, and environmental issues. A number of issues related to the operation of the plant have heightened our concerns, and they would include the following points. Two radiological leaks at the plant, which is now among the oldest operating nuclear plant in the United States. The storage of high-level radioactive nuclear waste inside and outside the plant in 27 dry casks, which sit on a cement pad in the floodplain of the Mississippi River near our homes, businesses, church, and community center. High voltage power lines running directly adjacent to many homes in our community. Tritium leaks and groundwater contamination. The transportation of hazardous materials to and from the plant. For example, just last year, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued a warning against Xcel for shipping radioactive testing equipment from the Prairie Island nuclear plant in the fall of 2008 that emitted between 5 and 10 times more radiation than safety standards allow. The recent loss of radioactive tools and equipment at the plant, while the loss was noticed by the plant staff on December 18th, the NRC wasn't notified until January 19th. A fire last week in a non-safeguard diesel generator, and recent NRC findings that criticize declining human performance at the plant. We remain concerned that the plant and waste storage facility will continue to pose an unacceptable risk to our community for the next several decades, if not longer. If the plant is relicensed for additional 20 years, as Xcel has proposed, 69 new waste casks could be necessary, bringing the total number of casks at Prairie Island to 98. These 98 casks would be at Prairie Island for close to 100 years, until 2094, a length that is completely unacceptable to our community. 28 years after Congress passed the Nuclear Waste Policy Act and mandated the establishment of a national repository, the future of the nation's nuclear waste disposal program remains very much in doubt. The proposed spent fuel repository at Nevada's Yucca Mountain has suffered numerous political and bureaucratic setbacks and has been abandoned by the Obama administration. Officially, Yucca Mountain was scheduled to begin accepting nuclear waste by 2010, but now it's unclear if it ever will be opened. Prairie Island believes the federal government must deliver on its promise to move nuclear waste to a safe, secure facility. Until that happens, however, the state of Minnesota must take appropriate action to deal with the long-term storage of nuclear waste. HF2440 is an important step in the right direction. It recognizes the Prairie Island Indian community as a host community. It recognizes the special risks, responsibilities, and financial burdens on the host communities and will help ensure that host communities are adequately funded to provide public safety, emergency response, and other necessary services, including fire and police protection. It can include the tribe as a member of the proposed Nuclear Waste Storage Commission, and did task the commission with developing a strategy for management and security of high-level radioactive waste. Continuous environmental monitoring and monitoring of the health of safe and of safety residents. Minnesota needs a plan to deal with the long-term storage of nuclear waste. We welcome the opportunity to participate in this effort, and we look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you, President Winfrey. Mayor?
Hi there.
Please say your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Clint Herbst. I'm here not to do the heavy lifting. I'm here just to kind of talk a little bit about the issues that we're facing. I know that we're all elected to make decisions and solve problems. I served three terms as a council member, and I'm currently on my third term as a mayor, and it's because we're willing to go out there and solve problems. As Representative Atkins stated, if you had a problem that your employee needed to solve and 28 years later it's still not done, there would be serious problems there. I'm not going to hit on the things that everyone else has said here. I'm basically going to talk about Monticello is very excited to have XL Energy in our backyard, to the point that we fully supported their relicensing a number of years ago, and in doing so, we didn't want to have the same old thing that it's okay in your backyard, not in our backyard. So we went out and we looked at Yucca Mountain. I don't know if anyone's had the opportunity to go out there, but it's basically a desert. And I'm not saying that it's less valuable than the shores of the Mississippi, but I think that the environment is certainly better suited to store this waste into the future. So it's a little bit unnerving to me that we've collected $33 billion over this amount of time. So far, they've used about $13 billion to dig a hole in the ground, and now we're saying no more. Had we known that 5 years ago when XL was looking to relicense, if we had known that we were going to have this sitting on the shores of the Mississippi, something that we possibly could end up dealing with for generations to come, we might have taken a little different look at it. There's some concern from XL that they're going to lose their place in line if we divert this funding. Right now, there's no line. We talked about this morning on the way up here through the snowstorm. There's no line out there. This is our opportunity to tell the federal government we're not going to collect Minnesota dollars and ship it off somewhere else. We should keep those dollars here so we can try to figure out solutions in case we end up with this for long term. So, basically, I think Red Wing's in the same position that we are. Had we known that we were going to be watching all this for years to come, we might have taken a little bit different stance. Until we find a place that we can store this safely into the future, we're not going to see relicensing occur. We're not going to see more plants go online. And maybe that's some people's goal, but I think we have to look at every opportunity going into the future. And this is a problem that we need to solve, all of us together. And I think Minnesota can be the leaders in this. I think that we need to be the leaders. I know Monticello has taken that stance on a couple different issues that we've been going with. Maybe some of you have seen it in the media, but we've decided that we're going to put the United States in front of just Monticello, and if we can be the small little wheel that gets us turning, that's what we need to do, and I think that you guys have a great opportunity to put Minnesota out there as a leader and to take care of this. I appreciate it, and I would take any questions also.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Chair Atkins.
Mr. Chair, the essence of what the bill does, and all of the testifiers, and I appreciate their being here today, all of them alluded to it. It's a very simple, straightforward solution. Over the last 28 years, Minnesota ratepayers, electric customers, have paid in with interest over $600 million to the Nuclear Waste Fund. They have zero to show for it. All this bill does is it says that that ongoing amount that's continuing to be paid, over $1 million a month, will be kept here in Minnesota. Half of it will be used for the Nuclear Waste Storage Commission that would be newly formed to address public safety issues and planning issues with respect to the nuclear waste that is continuing to remain here, has remained here for 30 years, and is likely to remain here, according to the U.S. Energy Secretary, for up to another 50 years or more. The second thing it does is it takes the other half and it escrows the funds. And what it says is as soon as the federal government shows that it can actually create a permanent storage site, we'll release those funds. It gives us a little bit of leverage that we've never had before to just go on and continue to pay and pay and pay. $14 million a year with absolutely nothing to show for it is like paying the garbage man 28 years and never having the garbage man show up to take the garbage away. It makes no sense at all, and it ought to be stopped. It's time to find a different approach. With that, I think we'd be happy to sit for any questions that members of the committee may have, and then I believe that Excel has some folks that would like to be heard from as well.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, how will we do this? I had a question about the Federal Energy Secretary and why did they decide. I've been to Yucca Mountain, and I agree it's a much better place to put the waste from all over the country, not just from here. But what prompted the federal government to decide Yucca Mountain won't work?
Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoppe, I think you'd best take that up with the U.S. Secretary of Energy Chu or the other folks in the federal government. All I know is that they're not taking our waste. They said they'd take it as of 1998. They're still not doing that, and we have to find a new course to follow because, according to recent comments just 10 days ago from Secretary Chu, it looks like we may hold this waste for another 50 years or more right here on the shores of the Mississippi.
Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We had one other question from Representative Davids, but he's had another meeting he had to sneak out to. So
probably a really hard question, though, so maybe it's
so
good that he...
So be ready for that. with that, thank you for coming up, and then stick around, please. There might be further questions. Ms. McCartan?
Good morning, Chair. Members.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you. My name is Laura McCartan. I work at Xcel Energy, and I'm here today to speak to House File 2440, I believe. I do have a handout for the members if someone wanted to get that. Well,
I make a heck of
okay.
a page,
yes,
too.
Yes, you do.
No, he doesn't.
No?
You want me to just put these right
I'm just
They'll pass those around and go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, as I said, I'm Laura McCartan with Northern States Power Minnesota and Xcel Energy Company. I'm Regional Vice President there. I started at the company in 1979, actually, as a nuclear engineer. And in my career, I've worked on the Prairie Island Dry Storage Facility. And most recently, I worked on a major transmission project, the CapEx 2020 project. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to speak to you about this bill. Let me first point out just a couple of, I think, very important facts about our nuclear plants at Monticello and Prairie Island. These plants play a vital role in meeting our customers' energy needs. They're what we call a baseload plant. They essentially run 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, except for refueling outages. So they are day-in, day-out workhorses of our system. They are carbon-free and safe and reliable, and we... And have been so for their for the last 20-plus years. They provide about 28% of our customers' energy needs. And they employ together over 1,200 people full-time and provide significant benefits to their local communities. We definitely appreciate the efforts of Representative Atkins and our host communities to press the federal government to comply with its legal and contractual obligations to remove used fuel from the nuclear plants. We share that goal wholeheartedly. Xcel Energy has long been and continues to be frustrated by the federal government's failure to start removing the used fuel from our nuclear power plants. The National Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition was largely formed as a result of the efforts of Minnesotans working together to make our voices heard on the national level about the urgency of this need. The coalition includes the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, the City of Red Wing, the Prairie Island Indian Community, and Xcel Energy, and many others. In addition to supporting the coalition's efforts, Xcel Energy has taken other steps to move the federal government to action. We were one of the first commercial nuclear power plant operators to sue the federal government for partial breach of contract for its failure to show up in 1998 and start removing the used nuclear fuel. Virtually every nuclear licensee has since followed suit, and the federal government's liability as a result of its not proceeding as it's supposed to do by contract is growing at the rate of $1 billion annually. As the total liability grows, we believe that more people will take notice and will bring more pressure on the federal government to fulfill its obligation. On this front, the most recent positive development occurred just last week when the United States Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., ruled that the Department of Energy cannot claim that delay was unavoidable. Each lawsuit and each positive decision brings additional pressure to bear on the federal government to complete its task. The federal government's obligation to take possession and permanently dispose of used nuclear fuel is a clear and unchanged policy. President Obama and Secretary Chu have reiterated that there is a federal obligation and that they intend to fulfill that obligation. President Obama announced that he will convene a Blue Ribbon panel to take a fresh look at a national waste disposal program. We believe it's prudent to let that Blue Ribbon panel take stock of the advances that have been made since the nation started its search for a national repository and to examine the potential for significant technological advancements. And we remain committed to working with our national partners to keep the federal solution moving forward. Now I'd like to speak about the particulars of House File 2440. Although we share the proponent's goal of pressuring the federal government to comply with its obligations, we do have serious concerns with this proposal. We believe it will have unintended consequences that are not in the best interest of our customers nor the state. Our concerns fall into three areas. First, we believe this bill would lead to Minnesota having to go it alone to solve disposal solutions for the nuclear waste that's generated in the state. Second, we believe that this will increase costs to our customers in several areas. We currently are seeking about $350 million in damages from the United States government on behalf of our customers for the partial breach of contract by not having begun spent fuel removal in 1998. There's also a chance that the amount our customers have paid into the nuclear waste fund could be at risk of being recovered. And also, we believe it would jeopardize the continued operation of these carbon-free and safe, reliable nuclear power plants. Our final concern is that the bill would unnecessarily duplicate an existing comprehensive funding and dry storage management requirement framework that exists under current federal and state law. First, let me address the concern about this bill possibly leading to Minnesota having to go it alone and also the potential financial consequences to customers. As was mentioned, we pay about $13 million a year to the Nuclear Waste Fund, which is collected from our customers. This is a condition of participation in the Federal Nuclear Waste Management Program under the 1982 Nuclear Waste Policy Act, and as well the associated contract between Northern States Power and the U.S. Department of Energy. One element of the original lawsuit we brought against the federal government for partial breach of contract was to request authority to escrow the funds we are paying into the Nuclear Waste Fund. The courts rejected that proposal. Last year, we supported a similar bill that was introduced by Representative Atkins that would escrow the funds but contingent upon repeal of the nuclear waste fee. We were instrumental in getting an amendment to that effect introduced in Congress. But the current bill, House File 2440, we believe would put the company in breach of contract with the Department of Energy, and that would have very serious ramifications. The Federal Waste Management Program covers only those utilities that have a contract with the federal government as of 1983. If we breach the contract, we arguably lose not just our place in the queue, but our eligibility to even use the federal repository. Breaching the contract, we believe, also risks loss of the hundreds of millions of dollars that our customers have paid into the Nuclear Waste Fund for permanent disposal. We also believe the federal government would argue that failure to continue payment into the Nuclear Waste Fund would eliminate our standing to sue the federal government for partial breach of contract. I mentioned we have already received judgments for $116 million of damages associated with that partial breach. We have a lawsuit pending that would seek to recover another $250 million. So those, and that would be to the customer's benefit, and that would be at risk, we believe, and jeopardized by breaching the contract. And finally, we believe that breaching the contract would jeopardize our pending application to the Nuclear Regulatory, to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to renew the operating licenses at the two units at Prairie Island, and potentially could even jeopardize the existing licenses of those power plants. In addition to these consequences, we believe the federal government would immediately challenge the state's authority to escrow payments into the Nuclear Waste Fund. And we believe they would very likely be successful in that legal challenge and thus negating the goal of the legislation and causing the state to incur the cost to deal with that legal challenge. On the question of management of used fuel, our concern with the bill is that it unnecessarily duplicates existing and comprehensive state and federal regulatory processes that are in place to assure safe storage of spent fuel from nuclear plants in Minnesota. There currently exist many layers of reviews and requirements related to not only plant operation and emergency response plants, but also to on-site used fuel storage. There are many requirements and regulations that assure there will be adequate funding, not only for continued used fuel storage after the plant stop operating, but also for complete decommissioning of the power plants and of the storage facilities and taking them to greenfield conditions after they're no longer being used. And I think it's important to understand that a little bit more about this framework, because this is an area that I'd just like to take a couple steps back and say that we definitely agree with Representative Atkins, with our host community representatives here, as well as the Prairie Island Indian community, that it's absolutely essential that there be safe storage of spent fuel or used nuclear fuel, as well as safe operation of the nuclear power plants, and that funding for long-term needs needs to be in place and assured. Federal law requires that used fuel storage facilities must be licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, whether or not the plant is operating. The NRC license governs all operations of the storage facility, including monitoring, radiation detection, emergency response and planning, security, financial assurance, and decommissioning. Federal regulations classify a used fuel storage facility as a protected facility, and the significance of that is there must be a physical protection system, state-of-the-art intrusion detection devices, camera monitoring and security patrols, etc. And access to a storage facility, whether or not there's a power plant operating, would be controlled at the same high level as is in place to control access to the protected area of the nuclear plant. Under state law, the plant and storage facility are included in the state's Emergency Management Act, which provides for integrated emergency responses to events such as hazardous waste releases and natural disasters. And these plans include all levels of government, including federal, state, county, and city. Under that law, the city of Red Wing and Goodhue County, as well as the city of Monticello and Wright County, have developed detailed emergency response plans that include roles and responsibilities, decision-making chains and communication procedures, emergency equipment and locations, evacuation centers, and transportation plans. These plans are drilled annually, and under existing law, the parties are reimbursed for costs that they incur related to the nuclear part of that emergency drill. A question with respect to the question of funding, our concern with this proposed legislation is that it would duplicate and or divert funding sources that are in place for two purposes. First is managing used fuel after plant shutdown, and second is local services and emergency response. Funding is already in place today for management of used fuel after plant shutdown. Both the Nuclear Regulatory Commission on the federal level and the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission on the state level require Xcel Energy to set aside enough money today on an ongoing basis from our customers to assure that there's adequate funds in the future to fully decommission the power plant, to safely and adequately store the used fuel on site after plant operation. Today we have nearly $1 billion in a trust fund that is specifically targeted for these purposes. This amount will continue to grow over time. It's also an amount that is subject to a review. Every 3 years, the company is required to file what is called a nuclear decommissioning accrual plan. This is the most recent one here. This goes to the Minnesota Public Utility Commission. It's reviewed in detail as to what assumptions are in place to project the cost for decommissioning for used fuel storage after plant shutdown. This happens every 3 years. The commission has the authority to direct us to change the assumptions, to take account of the most recent developments, whether it's on a federal level or with respect to engineering processes that would be used to decommission the plant. And they can order us to change that and reset the collection level from our customers. Where we are today, if our nuclear power plants operate through their extended license period, which is 2030 for Monticello and 2033 and 34 for Prairie Island Units 1 and 2, there will be 7 triennial decommissioning plans and reviews, and that will provide ample opportunity to reset the collection rate if that is necessary. There's also funding in place for local services and emergency response. State law provides for nuclear power plants for the emergency response planning and equipment for nuclear power plants and for reimbursement to local units of government that participate in it. This happens through the state's nuclear safety preparedness account, which is funded through an assessment on Xcel Energy. With respect to the funding for local services and emergency response, this issue was thoroughly evaluated in the 2009 Prairie Island Certificate of Need proceeding, which was overseen by the Minnesota Public Utility Commission, and as a result of which they approved additional used fuel storage at the Prairie Island site. This was an almost year-long independent process in front of an administrative law judge. The City of Red Wing fully participated in this and provided expert testimony and witnesses as to this issue. In the end, the administrative law judge determined there was no showing of need for dedicated payment to the city for emergency services. This doesn't mean that host communities don't deserve and, in fact, receive additional compensation for being host communities. We think it's proper that they do, and, in fact, they do. Under Minnesota's tax structure, host communities receive extra compensation for public services as a result of the personal property tax paid on equipment in the power plant.
Mr. Harden?
Yes?
Just 1 second, please.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Just to one point, you mentioned that who found that there was no need, and I know we're supposed to wait after, but I didn't want to miss this, who found that there was no need for additional monies to Monticello and Red Wing?
Ms. McCartan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this was a finding in the Certificate of Need proceeding, which is the Minnesota Public Utility Commission proceeding, and the purpose of that was to examine whether the Prairie Island plant should be allowed to have more used fuel storage capacity on its plant site. The issue of emergency response and what it takes to ensure that there are adequate emergency response facilities was an issue looked at in that proceeding.
Okay.
The administrative law judge made that conclusion, and I believe it was adopted by the Public Utility Commission.
So the judge,
Representative David,
thank you, Mr. Chair. The judge decided and the PUC agreed that no extra money was needed for the host communities for public safety.
Ms. McCartan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that the judge determined there was not any evidence in the proceeding that would lead to that conclusion that additional funds were needed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please
thank
proceed.
You. And thank you for your patience. I'm trying to wrap up here. I appreciate your attention here. I'd like to direct your attention to the handout that was given to you. I want to explain just a little bit about how Minnesota tax structure does direct additional compensation to host communities. And there is a chart in there, and I apparently have not took myself a copy. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I have it. There's a chart that illustrates for Xcel Energy and for purposes of the committee members, I'm holding it up here. This chart shows the property taxes that Xcel Energy has paid from the, over the period 1976 to 2008. The red line is what Xcel Energy has paid. The blue line is an example of what we would have paid if we weren't taxed as a utility and if the equipment within the power plants weren't taxed with a personal property tax. It's about, well, you can see the difference there. The difference between these two lines is money that does go to host communities as extra compensation in recognition of that special status. That's overall for Xcel Energy as a whole, just to illustrate an example, and this goes back to the certificate of need proceeding, since I mentioned that as far as Red Wing. In 2009, Xcel Energy paid about $11 million in property taxes on the Prairie Island plant. Of this total, $4.2 million went to Red Wing. A comparably valued manufacturer would have paid about $425,000. So the difference between $4.2 million and $425,000, approximately $3.8 million, is the amount that is in recognition of them being a host community. The extra compensation is one way to think of that for the property taxes. And from the level of $4.2 million in 2009, we anticipate our property taxes to the city will grow to over $9 million by 2017 as a result of our planned improvements at the power plant. Again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this concludes my prepared remarks. I want to again thank you for the opportunity to be here and say that we appreciate efforts and we share the goal to pressure the federal government to act on its obligation. And I would be happy at this point to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Ms. McCartan. Please just stick around. I think we're going to maybe have questions after a little bit here.
Thank you, sir.
Ms. Henkel? And just Representative Davids, we skipped over. I know you had a question earlier, and perhaps when Ms. Henkel's done, then we can have your question then.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that. And I've got a bill up over across the way here, too, so I may not be here, so they may luck out or they may become tremendously informed.
We're always open to education. Ms. Henkel, please state your name and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Annette Henkel, and I'm president of the Minnesota Utility Investors. We are a grassroots organization of approximately 27,000 members. Many of you who know who our members are, they're predominantly 65, 70, 75 years retired Minnesotans living in Minnesota. You've heard a lot of testimony today, and I'm just here very briefly to identify some of our concerns with House File 2440. Now, let me be clear. We do recognize that managing of the nuclear waste is a significant issue and challenge, and it is something that needs to be addressed. We, too, have members and members who have kids and grandkids that live and work in the areas of these nuclear plants. But part of our concern with this legislation, from our perspective, is that it does not help move forward the issue of managing nuclear waste. If redirecting this fee to a state fund puts Xcel Energy in default of their federal contract, our members are very concerned about the financial impact this will have on the company, thus impacting our members as shareholders and owners of this company. And you know our members. They rely upon the success of their utility investments for much of their livelihood. In addition, our members are ratepayers too, and they pay into this National Waste Fund. And they are concerned that with this legislation, by default, would create a new fee, another fee to be directed, so you'd have this fee going to the national fund as well as this Minnesota new state fund. We recognize the frustration with the federal government not fulfilling their end of the bargain to build a national repository, but we do not believe that this legislation, which would penalize our members as shareholders and ratepayers, is the answer. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Over the weekend, we received a call from Ms. McAbee. I don't know, is she here? I don't see any movement. Chair Atkins, if you'd like to come forward. Do you have any comments before questions? Or
Just a very brief reply. Part of the reason this bill is before this committee is because we look out for consumer protection issues. We do contract and business sorts of stuff. And In Minnesota, the average electric customer is now paid over $575 for the Nuclear Waste Fund with absolutely nothing to show for it. With interest over $600 million just for Minnesota electric customers has gone into this fund. Well, I appreciate Excel's concern that this would, if we failed to pay or refused to pay any more into this fund, that somehow would be a breach of contract, and that seems to be their chief argument that leads to all of their consequences. The fact is the federal government breached this contract a long time ago. Excel's own lawsuit, in which they won a $116 million judgment, demonstrates that the federal government breached this contract long ago. And I might add, you got this handout. There is Secretary Chu, the U.S. Energy Secretary, I quote, said the Obama administration is committed to seeing that the controversial Yucca Mountain storage site near Las Vegas that would hold nuclear waste never opens. Yucca Mountain is completely is off the table, he said. However, he said that should not interfere with building new nuclear power plants because, and I quote, spent nuclear fuel can be safely stored on site at reactor locations for at least another 50 years. That's from Reuters just 10 days ago. If that isn't a game changer, folks, I don't know what is. We paid in 28 years already. If we're going to be anticipated to pay in another 50 years or more, which is what Secretary Chu's own comment would tend to lead one to believe, that's crazy. The garbage man that hasn't showed up for 28 years apparently isn't going to show up for 50 more. And to keep paying and to consider that that somehow makes sense is ludicrous. We need to follow a new course. I've learned over the weekend that apparently the state of Missouri, others have indicated similar interest in pursuing a new course with the federal government, and I'd urge that Minnesota be a leader in that discussion. With that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions now that the ever-enlightening Representative David's question is no longer here. We won't be able to find out what that said, but if there's other questions or comments that members would have, I'd welcome those. Otherwise, I'd anticipate, I hope that this bill will travel through the appropriate committees and probably come back before this committee, before it would hit the floor for those consumer protection contract sorts of issues.
Thank you, Chair Atkins. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Willie. Representative Atkins, one of the testifiers, Laura McCartan, mentioned that we would lose a place in a queue, some kind of list that if we went forward with your bill, that would be problematic. Are you aware of any queue, or have you seen any list that includes the state of Minnesota for
Chairman
Mountain?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I appreciate the question. To quote, first off, Mayor Herbst from Monticello, who says there is no queue because there is no facility, and there's no likely facility, according to Secretary Chu, for another five decades or more. It doesn't matter whether you're in a line or not, which sounds a little flippant, but if there's no facility, there can't be any line for that facility. Other than that, I'm not aware of there being any particular line to get into a facility because there's been no planning with respect to where a facility other than Yucca Mountain, which is now completely off the table. There is no facility in the planning works. There is no pecking order with respect to who gets to send their waste there first, nor is there any plan for how that waste would be transported from here to there. As a result, we end up being the de facto permanent storage site, at least for the next half century or so. We've already endured a quarter century of that, and it looks like it's not coming to an end anytime soon.
Representative Johnson, any other questions? I just noticed that we're joined by Senator Murphy in the audience from the community of Red Wing, and I just want to mention while he's here, and I have the gavel, I guess I'm going to take it. What a pleasure it's been to serve with you, sir, and you've been a top-notch representative for your area and our state, so thank you for that. Chair Atkins, any final comments?
Again, I'd do the same. I'd welcome Senator Murphy. Thank him for joining us here today. I know that he has a strong interest in this bill as well.
And I think on behalf of all of us, we appreciate his service in the legislature. He just announced his retirement, what, about 15 minutes ago or a couple days ago? And I think a lot of people appreciate the service that he's given to the state of Minnesota.
Seeing no further questions, we stand in recess. 1 hour.
Until 1 o'clock.
Oh, 1 o'clock, excuse me. 1 o'clock.
I recall the Joint Committee of the Commerce and Labor Committee of the House and the Senate Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee of the Senate to order. We've got three important bills to talk about this afternoon, and we want to get out of here. They get the latest by 3:30. People have other meetings, so we'll shoot for 2 hours or so, 2 hours and 15 minutes. And I discussed this with Senator, Representative Atkins. I think what we'll do is, without objection, hear all three bills. Explain the three to us. Then I think we'll get into people in favor, and then after that we'll go to the opposition. So that's, I think, how we're going to proceed here. So, Representative Liebling, welcome, and good to see you again. And I'll do House File 491 and at first and explain the bill to us.
All right. Thank you, Senator. And Senators and Representatives, thank you very much, first of all, for taking the time to hear these bills. These issues can be a bit complicated, and it's good to have this piece of time set aside. I'm just going to very briefly just give the briefest introduction. I'm going to turn it over to Pete Wyckoff to talk just a little bit about the Minnesota Prescription Coalition that is behind this, and then we're going to thank you for hearing all three. We're going to try to make the presentation as cohesive as we can. The goal of all three of these bills is to improve the safety and efficacy of treatments and to control costs. Everyone, we know there's a lot of talk about healthcare reform these days. Everyone really shares these goals. But we do have a system in which sometimes it's hard to achieve these goals. Sometimes the profit motive comes into play. Sometimes it's simply fear of change. But we know that healthcare costs are out of control, and doing nothing is not an option. These three bills, together and separately, move us toward these goals: safety, efficacy, and cost containment. And now with that, I'm going to turn it over to Pete Wyckoff, who's going to explain a little bit about the Minnesota Prescription Coalition.
Wyckoff, welcome to the Joint Committee.
The joys of PowerPoint.
Good.
Senator Metzen, Representative Atkins, committees, I'm very pleased to be here and that you saw the need for this interim hearing and taking the advantage to look at these issues carefully as well. I'm Peter Wyckoff. I am a national consultant for Community Catalyst, and working in collaboration with the Minnesota Prescription Project and staff to the Minnesota Prescription Coalition. Before my retirement in the end of 2006, I, for 33 years, was the founder and director of the Minnesota and Metropolitan Senior Federations. The Minnesota Prescription Coalition is a broad-based group of organizations coming together to improve the way prescription drugs are prescribed and to bring down drug costs for individuals, government entities, and providers. We were formed just a few months ago. Members include key stakeholders from a wide spectrum of interests, including healthcare providers, payers, consumers, labor, commerce, academia, healthcare, and state agencies. A listing of those in the material which has been presented for you. Momentum is growing across the country among consumers, providers, and policy experts to establish objective, evidence-based methods for getting accurate information into the hands of physicians and all prescribers. Increasing frustration at the federal and national level about the negative impacts of the pharmaceutical and marketing influence is at an all-time high. We as a coalition are working to promote prescribing integrity, specifically to ensure patients have access to quality, appropriate, and affordable medications, to increase evidence-based use of drugs and medical devices across the state of Minnesota, and to reduce the conflicts of interest between Minnesota prescribers and the pharmaceutical industry. Through educational activities and public policy initiatives at both the state and national level, the Minnesota Prescription Coalition seeks to increase the quality and the safety of prescribing of drugs by physicians, to reduce conflicts of interest, and to ultimately reduce the amount we spend on prescription drugs. We are asking for three pieces of legislation to be considered by your respective committees. One, to prohibit pharmaceutical companies from buying doctors prescribing information and using that information to directly target individual doctors. Secondly, to establish an independent prescriber education program to provide doctors once and for all unbiased information as to increase the prescribing of the best, safest, and most effective prescriptions. And thirdly, to improve on the transparency and reporting laws already in this state to more clearly define and limit undue relationships between providers and pharmaceutical companies. We hope that the testimony you're about to hear from local and national experts will provide you the kind of information from authorities recognized literally internationally in their field in this area that will help you to look at supporting this legislation. Support this legislation that will improve quality and improve safety of prescribing in Minnesota and reduce costs to all payers, including consumers, health plans, and state government. I'd like to introduce Dr. Stephen Schondemeyer, who's a pharmaceutical doctor and PhD, who's the head of the Department of Pharmacology Care and Health Systems, and the endowed chair of pharmaceutical management, economics professor, director of the Prime Institute, University of Minnesota.
I know Senator Marty and Senator Sharon, and who's the other Senate author?
Senator Dolly.
Oh, Senator Dolly. In which bills, Doctor, do you know? Or
Senator Marty will speak about the gift ban legislation that will follow this presentation, which is an overall presentation.
Okay, it's not listed here who the Senate author is, so I thought Senator the Lawson, audience should know.
Senator Sharon, who can't be here today, is actually on the academic detailing in the House.
Yes.
In the Senate, pardon me. And the data mining legislation is Representative John Dahl.
Okay, I just wanted everybody in the room and senators and House members to know the authors. Okay.
And Liebling is author of all three bills in the House.
I see that. Okay, Dr. Schondemeyer.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you to the co-chairs of this committee. I appreciate the committee for the opportunity to present to you. I want to talk about what I think are some pressing policy issues we need to address with respect to prescription drugs and medical devices. Many of the same principles apply. By way of overview, the topics I want to discuss are, first, acknowledge the value of drugs and devices. Second, comment on both the benefits and costs that these drugs and devices bring to us. Third, look at their impact on health and drug expenditures. Then, remind us that we have growing needs for health care and limited resources as a society. Then describe the costs of medications and what I call externalities and their role as costs. And then conclude by suggesting that we can increase the value of both drugs and devices through management of both the benefits and the costs. And I have copies of my PowerPoint, so I would ask you not to get too lost in the slides. I'll try to also go quickly over some of the data-driven slides, even though there's a lot of information there. The first point is, I sincerely acknowledge that prescription drugs and medical devices bring great value to us as a society. This isn't about saying we don't need drugs or drug companies or we don't need devices or device companies. This certainly isn't about saying we don't need innovation. I work at the University of Minnesota. Our motto is driven to discover. Our purpose is finding innovation and new ways of doing things. Sometimes those new ways are finding the actual new drugs and devices. Sometimes it's how do we use those more efficiently or how do we get more value for our money. In particular today, I'm talking about how do we get more value for the money we do spend on those devices as a society. Drug therapy has been beneficial. We've had improved healthcare options and outcomes. People have more choices for treatment today than they've ever had. They have improved health outcomes for many disease states today, and that's brought about through the drugs and devices we have available on the marketplace. People have many times improved quality of life and length of life. So these are broad and fully acknowledged benefits brought to us by drugs. But not all drug use is beneficial. Sometimes we have inappropriate drug use that adds to cost. I'll mention it again later, but just recently an article came out about the antidepressant category of drug therapy And clinical research suggests that for mild and even moderate symptoms of depression, that these drugs are no better than placebo. So essentially we're wasting the money we spend on them, except for the patients with severe depressive disorders. And when you look at the percentage of patients that have mild and moderate depressive symptoms being treated, it's been estimated these are as much as 40, 50, or even 70% of all patients on these drugs. So we may be wasting all of that. In fact, Medicaid program, about a fourth of all of its total expenditures are for antidepressants alone. Also, we have limited information on drug effectiveness and safety. There are times when the drug company knows more about a drug than practicing physicians or we as society. A particularly egregious example of that was related to the drug Vioxx in Merck Company, where they knew some results of their trials early on and what was happening and kind of tried to hide that, and the courts have dealt with, you know, what happened there and what the consequences are. But there was pretty good evidence that the drug company knew more than they were telling the people prescribing it, and yet they kept promoting the drug actively for a number of years after they knew that this drug might be causing more harm than good in some cases. Key research questions are not even being asked or studied today for a whole variety of reasons I'll discuss. Price information is not easily identifiable or known, and people aren't making price-value decisions. It's hard to find who makes the price-value decision in healthcare for drugs and devices. We can decide, we can find out who prescribes it, but we don't know who makes that price-value decision, and it may not be happening. And finally, costs sometimes exceed the marginal value, and sometimes the costs are higher than what the value is or contribution to society. So by way of slides, this slide tells us the health expenditures as a share of the overall gross domestic product. The United States is the blue line there at the beginning, 16% of our economy on health. The rest of these are OECD countries, in other words, major developed countries throughout Europe and other parts of the world. The average OECD country spends 8.9% of their economy on health. We're spending 16%. And notice that gap there between 11%, France is 11%, the highest country next to the U.S. I didn't leave out all the countries between France and the U.S. There aren't any. We are not only the highest, but substantially higher than others. This next slide shows pharmaceutical expenditures per capita. This is reduced to the U.S. purchasing power parity, or the same comparable dollars. This is the amount spent on pharmaceuticals then per person across countries. Again, I didn't leave out the countries that spend more than the U.S. We spend more on pharmaceuticals in dollars. Some people may show you numbers that show us a percent we spend less on drugs, but I would ask you, what is it you take to the bank at the end of the day, percent or dollars? I don't know any bank that accepts percents. They all look for dollars. If you do, I'd like to have the name of the bank. Got a deal I can work out with them. So we spend more than other countries on pharmaceuticals also. I track for the AARP the prices of drugs used by the elderly and the same drugs over time. And the green line here is inflation. And you might recall that the elderly this year did not get any cost of living increases in their supplemental income. So they got no increase in their Social Security supplemental income, but prescription drug prices for brand name and specialty drugs have gone up 8.7% and 9.3% respectively in 2008. In 2009, the trend's even higher than this. And this is in the face of the time where Medicare Part D was supposed to be holding down costs and slowing the rate of inflation. And the full report and the methods and description of this is on the AARP website. At a congressional hearing in Washington a month or so ago, we were criticized for this number because we included some brand name drugs that now face generic competition. We've actually reanalyzed the numbers, and when we take out the drugs that have faced generic competition, the inflation rate's slightly higher than what we've reported. So we were criticized as if that would bring down the inflation rate, but it didn't. Again, we'll make our methods open and transparent. Something else I noticed is over time, and this shows from 1950 through 2008 data and then projected after 2015, we use more drugs as a society. This is what we call prescription use intensity. The measure here is number of prescriptions per person per year. That is, typically a prescription is a one-month supply of a medication you would get at a pharmacy, and then you would go back the next month. So if you had one chronic med and you were getting it filled once a month, that would be 12 prescriptions per person per year. Over time, what we've seen is this rate of prescription intensity use in society has nearly doubled every 20 years. But notice in about 1997, the trend line, the yellow line here, goes up from the trend line that had been steady for nearly three or four decades. And it happens to be exactly when direct-to-consumer advertising began to expand, particularly to television in the U.S. Now, I'm not saying that direct-to-consumer advertising was the only cause of this change, but it is amazingly coincidental to the time when the dramatic uptick in prescription drug use occurred. And I think there is some relationship and some of that increased use. Now, some of that increased use is people who needed the drug and didn't know about it and they're getting it. But some of it is patients who didn't need the drug. They made an appointment with their doctor. They incurred additional doctor's visits, which cost their health plan or their employer more money, and then either got the medicine just to get them out of the doctor's office, or the doctor may have refused it. But there are added costs to the healthcare system created by that direct-to-consumer advertising. But who is the primary beneficiary of it? The drug company through their sales revenue. So we have to evaluate the impact of that. The major point here is there are growing needs, and there's growing technology in healthcare. But there are limited resources, as you acutely face each and every day you come to the legislature. I'm sure you're well aware of the resource limitations. So we have to learn to find ways to use our resources more wisely. What are the costs of medications? There are issues about conflicts of interest on prescribing. For example, if a physician's being given money above and beyond the cost of conducting clinical research, and it influences them to not publish the negative results of a study or to delay the publication, it means then that information is not out there for other prescribers to have, and doctors may continue prescribing a drug that isn't the most effective, like those antidepressant drugs we talked about, where now we find, after they've been on the market for a number of years, that these drugs are no better than placebo. Yet we assume that doctors one-on-one could figure all this out. Well, doctors are very smart and wise people, but sometimes we can be fooled by the marketing and led to believe other things. Failure to study adverse consequences. Often drug companies will include the adverse consequences that they're required to by law, but they don't look at adverse consequences beyond what they're required to. And we find out after the fact, for example, Vioxx had some major adverse consequences. We found out considerably after the drug had been on the market. We find out that some articles that are written in the peer-reviewed literature and in major publications have been ghostwritten by drug companies or their ad agencies or by physicians or other health scientists on the staff of the drug company, and then outside scientists put their names on it and publish them. Also, we get somewhat of a one-sided marketing influence. Drug companies are more than happy to and very effective at telling us about all the good things their drugs do, and that's their job. I understand that. But they don't always tell us about the full spectrum of the drug and the adverse effects. And yes, on TV you have them rattling off this drug that causes death, pain, you know, constipation, flatulence, and all those other things. They rattle off, but that doesn't give full fair balance. It doesn't help either the patient or the physician know how to weigh it. Yes, it's better than not saying it at all.
Doctor, when you get done with the warnings,
yes.
Who can take the drugs?
Well, that's
do not take this if you're, you know.
One thing we may realize is we may not need to use as many drugs as we are, or we may be misusing some of them. We also see inappropriate prescribing, as I described with the antidepressants, but it's not just the antidepressants. We've had similar evaluations tell us that the proton pump inhibitors for gastroesophageal reflux disease are overprescribed, and they actually cause increased acid secretion if you use them longer than they're supposed to be used, which commonly happens in practice. We've seen that the anti-inflammatory arthritis drugs have been overprescribed. There are diabetic medicines that have had consequences that we didn't realize, and we found out that measuring the blood glucose isn't the best outcome measure for the anti-diabetic drugs, and we've had to reevaluate our thinking. So there is inappropriate prescribing that occurs, and it leads not only to clinical impact and lack of progress in patients' clinical condition, but wasted expense by passing out and paying for drugs that aren't having any good effects. So we have costs in society. The prices and expenditures of drugs. On the one hand, if we have drugs that are effective and safe, and we increase our expenditures by making sure that people can get them and buy them, that's a good increase in our expenditures. We're giving people drugs that help them. But if the same drug goes up in price 10% this year over last year, the patient doesn't get 10% better this year. But yet we see our drugs going up at 8, 9, and 10% a year in prices. Some drugs going up 20, 25%. And yet another set of drugs, there's a small group of drugs, they're what we call extraordinary price increases, that have had price increases over 100% at a single point in time. That means it doubled overnight. And some of those were as much as 1,000% increase at a single point in time in the price of a drug. It's hard to imagine why that was needed in most cases. And then we see prescription drug abuse. We're finding out that the major source of prescription drug drug abuse for particularly young teenagers in the 12, 13 age range, the major source where they get drugs of abuse is from their parents' medicine cabinet and extra drugs sitting around. And there have been projects recently that deal with prescription drug waste. That is, people who have drugs, they got too much drug, it's sitting in their medicine cabinet, it's out of date, or the mail order sent an extra bottle, they didn't need it. And we're now collecting this at police stations and with pharmacists and physicians working together to safely dispose of it. We're also finding that not only does that create prescription drug access to people to use for abuse, but just dumping those drugs in our water system creates literal pollution. And it has been estimated that maybe 1/6 of the American population is using water supplies that have prescription drug traces in it that could be causing adverse consequences. So literally, prescription drugs have become a pollution problem. The proposed legislation you're going to hear about today deals with academic detailing and practitioner education, deals with conflict of interest disclosure and gift bans, and it deals with bans on data mining for promotion purposes. Now, this doesn't say that you can't use this data for other research purposes. It doesn't say that you can't provide payments to doctors or health practitioners if they're for a bona fide service or clinical research program. But this puts some limits. What I want to point out is that the cost of production and distribution of pharmaceuticals and medical devices, for that matter, if it doesn't bear the entire cost of to society of using those drugs, if the producer doesn't bear the entire cost, it means that we create externalities that are dumped off on the rest of society. This is just like we face with air and water pollution. Sometimes we say we need those factories that produce goods and services, even though they may be causing some pollution, so we're going to push the cost of pollution back on those producers by water pollution control, air pollution control, and other measures. In many ways, what we see in pharmaceuticals is we have some costs being dumped off on the rest of society, that is inappropriate prescribing, over-prescribing, overpricing in some cases, and other factors. Drug firms flood the information channels, and it's largely with the positive benefits and not always a complete and fair balanced picture. Their sales reps are out there competing against, and we're trying to create academic detailing to bring some objectivity to the information. Direct-to-consumer advertisements, in some ways, create good, but they also bring people into the healthcare system that add cost to the employer and healthcare system that the drug company doesn't pay, but they benefit from it from increased sales. We see off-label promotion and use of drugs that sometimes is appropriate, but sometimes inappropriate use of drugs. We see industry-sponsored research and these ghost-written articles, and drug companies. Often the research done for drug companies and done by my colleagues in academia are very well done. They're well done scientifically, but they ask only the questions that the drug companies want to have asked. What are the good things about my product? Drug companies don't usually ask, what are the problems with my product and how do we assess the balance of good and bad things with my product in society? And so we have to also conduct those studies and make sure that when negative results occur that they get published so they can be weighed by the practitioners and scientists to determine which drugs will be used. Drug firms do add to the cost of the system. Their samples are not free. The detailing leads to prescribing behaviors, sometimes that are appropriate, sometimes that are inappropriate. Doctors' gifts have an influence. Every doctor will tell you, well, that little pen or that little clock on the wall won't influence me. And I think they sincerely believe that. But in aggregate, when studies are done, they show that those things do have an impact on prescribers in aggregate. Data mining, pulling data and using that to target market doctors and go back and say, doc, you didn't prescribe enough last month. you're going to have to prescribe. I got to make my bonus, and my kids need to go to school, and you know the personal selling that goes on through data mining, promotion, detailing does happen and does have an impact on us. And then lobbying, we'll leave that where it is, but lots of lobbying goes on from the industries involved here. The real policy issues are who bears the cost of all of this and how do we minimize those costs. These proposed pieces of legislation are about identifying what are the costs and who's bearing them, and most importantly, how do we minimize those costs. These are proposed pieces of legislation not to stop innovation and research and development in drug companies or device companies, but to minimize the cost of their activities in society and to make sure that we control and manage those costs. Drug firms also try to minimize and avoid competition by coming out with new dosage forms or strengths or left-handed versions of the drug or the right-handed version or combinations and sometimes authorized generics as ways to get around having true generic competition into the market. And this is where we see at the federal level they're talking about biosimilars and some other issues about getting true economic competition in the market much more quickly. The real goal here is to use comparative effectiveness, use up-to-date, evidence-based information to make informed decisions about treatment options to get us the most value, and that means the cost per outcome. Now, often you'll have people come and talk to you who may be from the industry that talk about value, 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 and you'll never hear once the word price or cost. It value equals quality. Value equals innovation. But value always includes in it cost and price. Value, as we've shown by the equation, is cost per outcome. But how can you know the good value and make good value decisions without real cost information? Price is not the only issue in value, but price is always an important issue in value. So price must always be taken into account. You can't discuss value without looking at price. In conclusion, really, we need and value the role of both drugs and devices. And that value can be increased if we recognize and manage the costs as well as the benefits of those drugs and devices. These bills are about helping us as a society manage the cost of those drugs and devices in terms of how they're used and how much we spend on them and how many people misuse them and how we minimize that so we can improve safety, effectiveness, and patient care outcome at the most efficient cost and help you use those limited resources you have as legislators much more effectively. Thank you very much.
Very good. We're going to go about till 10 after 2 or so for the proponents, so we should move along.
I think the plan, I'm talking to Chair Metzen ahead of time, due to the number of testifiers that we have, Representative Anderson, and some of them literally have to catch flights on their way back out, I think the goal is to take all of the testimony first, and then we'll circle back and take questions from members.
Sure. So,
all right.
That's good.
Mr. Chairman.
Marty, how are you?
I'm very pleased to be with you. I'm here to speak for 2 or 3 minutes on behalf of Senate File 1237, House File 1641, which is to sign to close some of the loopholes in our conflict of interest law that we've had since the early 90s. And the Institute of Medicine last year called for sweeping change in this area, asking states and doctors and everyone to recognize that these practices, quote, erode public trust while providing no meaningful benefits to patients or society. And Harvard doctors wrote an article in American Journal of American Medical Association a year or two ago saying that the standing of the profession is jeopardized by allowing obvious conflicts to continue. The serious threat that this state of affairs poses for professionalism and for trust that patients have in their physicians makes the need for effective guidelines on industry-physician relationships both apparent and urgent. Marketing and market value should not be allowed to undermine physicians' commitment to their patients' best interest or scientific integrity. And we've had lots of letters. I have one that could be distributed from Park Nicollet, heard from Health Partners, many others who are supporting this. St. Mary's Duluth Clinic has banned all, even little trinkets, everything from the industry. And this legislation would close some of the loopholes we've had in the law. I think that one of the things I want to point out, it does, among other things, it cleans up many of the small ambiguities. It would clarify that unrestricted granting to medical conferences is not allowed, provide transparency for practitioners who are receiving compensation from a industry that they have to disclose that to patients. It's a number of little, if you look through the legislation specifically, you'll see there are about six or seven changes we're making in the law. And this is a big issue when we're talking about the health cost of health care. And a lot of the health care reform, we all recognize the need to bring it under control. Just to give you a scope of this, the direct-to-consumer marketing in Minnesota is $100 million a year. The pharmacy marketing, the pharmaceutical manufacturer marketing to physicians is more than that. It's more than $100 million a year they're spending to try and influence patient behavior. I could go on more than that. I know you have a lot of witnesses, and I believe we have Alan Kukel from the Pew Prescription Project here. I'd be happy to take questions. I have to leave in a few minutes as well, but I realize we've got a very long agenda, so with that I'll conclude.
Appreciate Senator Marty. We'll move on to Alan Kukel. Welcome to the Joint Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to submit testimony. My name is Alan Kukel. I'm a pharmacist and director of the Pew Prescription Project, which is an initiative of the Pew Charitable Trusts to promote consumer safety through reforms in the manufacture and marketing of prescription drugs. And I'll talk a little bit today about the financial ties between companies and providers. Pharmaceuticals and medical devices are central to modern healthcare, and we need academic industry collaboration for their development, and that must and will continue. At the same time, as patients and as taxpayers, we need prescribing that's guided by sound evidence and good science, and every patient deserves the safest, most effective, and other things being equal, the least costly treatment. The industry spends heavily to influence physicians' choice of products. $30 billion a year is a conservative estimate from the New England Journal of Medicine. And another survey in the New England Journal of Medicine on my slide looks at physician-industry financial relationships. More than 90% of U.S. doctors have some kind of financial tie to the industry. In a lot of cases, that's accepting free meals or free gifts. But interestingly, about 1 in 5 is paid as a consultant, and about 1 in 10 is actually paid to give promotional talks about a particular product. Only around 3% of those relationships refer enrolling patients in clinical studies. So, a doctor choosing between drug A and drug B for his patient has a conflict of interest if he's being paid by the maker of drug A. Some financial ties, such as gifts, are unnecessary. They don't contribute to patient care, and it's easy to eliminate them. Other relationships, such as research, are necessary and beneficial, but greater transparency serves the public good. And this is consistent with recommendations by the Institute of Medicine, the Association of American Medical Colleges, and with changes being adopted at every level within the medical profession and even some individual companies. There's a large body of evidence, and we don't have time to sort of go into a lot of detail today, but looking at the influence of marketing, medical residents receive on average 75 giveaway items a year, lunches, dinners, pens, both open the doors for the sales rep and also influence judgment. And it's sort of our deep human nature. We're hardwired when someone gives us a gift to reciprocate. We all do it. We're not conscious of it, but they work. Surveys actually show that most physicians recognize this. It's been done a couple of times, and if you ask doctors, are you personally influenced by sales reps, only about 1% will say they're heavily influenced. But then you say, what about your peers? Are they heavily influenced? And the number goes way, way up. So it's sort of like the idea that we'd all like to think we're above average drivers, but we can't all be right. And interestingly, patients recognize the influence on prescribing. We did a survey, and there are a couple of surveys out there, and found that two-thirds of Americans actually support legislation requiring the disclosure of gifts and payments, as you're considering today. Minnesota has been a pioneer in this area. You were the first state to enact legislation limiting gifts above a certain value and requiring pharmaceutical companies to report payments. And the information that has been reported in Minnesota has been valuable. It has brought to light important conflicts of interest among people who are choosing, for instance, drugs to be used in your Medicaid program. And we've been looking at the Minnesota numbers, and there will be a detailed report forthcoming before long, but one interesting finding from data reported actually by companies in 2009 is that almost 90% of the fees that companies are reporting were not related to research or educational grants, but were in fact speaking fees for promotion. Other states, including Massachusetts and Vermont, have followed the lead of Minnesota and in some ways have gone further with more comprehensive disclosure provisions. And there's certainly leadership within the state at the University of Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic and Health Partners and Park Nicolet, among others. It's important also, I think, to note that the major pharmaceutical and medical device trade associations, along with individual companies, have endorsed transparency proposals at the federal level and have recommended that their members stop giving gifts to healthcare providers. Some companies are already disclosing financial relationships voluntarily. And while the number of companies taking voluntary action remains tiny, I think it does illustrate that disclosure is neither too onerous nor harmful to innovation. Since the passage of the Massachusetts statute last year, neither research dollars nor jobs have left the state, and indeed the Life Sciences Center is in the midst of major growth and investment, including expansions by Genzyme, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Shire Pharmaceuticals, and Acceleron Pharma. There is now pending disclosure legislation, the Physician Payment Sunshine Act, a bipartisan bill introduced by Senators Grassley and Cole and co-sponsored by Senators Klobuchar and Franken, was passed by the Senate along with health reform proposals in December. The House passed a similar provision, and as you know, the future of health care reform is uncertain at this point. But the important point is that the federal bill leaves states to act outside its scope. So, for example, states could place limits on gifts. The federal bill is a pure transparency bill. And both the House and Senate provisions contain very careful language that ensures, first, that companies won't face duplicate reporting requirements. In other words, if the federal bill collects it, states won't. That's good for business. But it also protects the rights of state legislatures to act. For example, if the U.S. Senate bill were passed, payments to nurses wouldn't be collected. But Minnesota does collect payments to nurse practitioners, and that could continue. And of note, that's been a rapidly increasing area of marketing in recent years. State leadership, particularly from Minnesota, will be and has been important and will continue to be. I applaud you for considering legislation that fixes some of the loopholes in the current legislation and expands its scope in a way that is part of a broad national trend towards restoring public trust, controlling health care spending, and protecting patients. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions at question time.
Thank you very much. Moving on, Representative Cindy Rosenwald from New Hampshire. Here. Thank you for traveling to our great state.
Well, it's my first trip here, and I'm really excited.
Gotta come back and spend some money and get to like us a little bit.
And you'll spend some money in New Hampshire.
Senator, in case she never comes back, we should encourage her to spend money this trip.
Okay.
Mall of America, right down the road. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Metzen and Representative Atkins. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I'm Representative Cindy Rosenwald, and I represent the 22nd District of Hillsborough County, which is Nashua. It's the very southern part of the state. As you know, we have an enormous house in New Hampshire, and so my unduplicated district is about 3,000 people. I have the honor to chair the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Elderly Affairs. Good, and my PowerPoint is up. But in my previous life, I was an advertising executive, and I worked primarily with healthcare and pharmaceutical clients. And I want to talk to you just briefly, and I'll try to be really quick, about the process of data mining physicians' prescribing records. This is something that's been going on for about 15 years, and what happens is that these companies, these health information companies, acquire physician prescribing records from pharmacies and from electronic medical record vendors. and they integrate this information on what physicians are specifically prescribing with database information they purchase from the American Medical Association on every physician in America, whether they are a member of the AMA or not. And they're able to track prescriptions written by specific prescribers for specific brands. And I think that it's particularly concerning that some of this physician profiling data or data mining also includes incompletely de-identified patient-level data from electronic medical records. A couple of years ago, I was invited to speak at a pharmaceutical industry conference, and one of the marketing companies that was there said, these new databases of patient data are a great marketing tool for the pharmaceutical industry because it allows you to more easily follow patients across sites of care. Now, if you can follow a patient from one doctor to another, that patient is not de-identified. There is at least a unique identifier attached to that patient. And recently I found on the internet a brochure for one of these data mining companies that said they could measure new drugs, continuing prescriptions, a switch from one medication to another, or restart with patient age and gender, as well as the prescriber specialty. This is very worrisome, particularly in rural populations, which we have a lot of in New Hampshire, because sometimes the name of a drug communicates what the diagnosis is. And in some places, even my own city, which has 90,000 people, if you talk about a 95-year-old woman with a senile dementia, it's not going to be very hard to figure out who that person is. And I think this data is very powerful because it's almost real time. So a drug rep comes into a physician's office and knows more about what that doctor has prescribed in the last week or two than that doctor has any clue what it is. And for the life of me, I cannot figure out any other industry that allows a company to collect such detailed data on its customers without their permission. I think the closest analogy are those reward cards from supermarket chains where you put in your little unique identifier barcode and it keeps a record of everything you've purchased at the supermarket that day. Now, I know when I'm using my card that they're selling that data to the food vending companies, but the difference is that I've given my permission for this, and I'm going to get some special discounts and sales out of it, too. And I also have the ability on any given day to keep that card in my wallet. So if I don't want them to sell what I'm buying that day, I just don't have to identify myself. But with physician prescribing, doctors don't have that kind of opportunity to just say no. So I believe that data mining of doctors' prescribing records is actually kind of a perfect storm. There's about $6.5 billion spent on the process of sending drug reps to doctors' offices, and there's a tenfold return on every dollar that's invested this way. And actually, the break-even point for one drug rep visit to one doctor is just one new prescription, which gives you a sense of how expensive those prescriptions really are. So if you cover your cost in one prescription, if you get two out of it, you've made basically 100% profit. And just very briefly, in my own state, our budget is being crippled by the cost of prescription drugs. It's the fastest growing sector of our health care. In our Medicaid program, the cost of prescription drugs is equal to that for doctors and hospitals combined, and for our prisoners, it's equal to doctors, hospitals, and diagnostics combined. We're small, we're a healthy state, but it's just, it's incredibly expensive for us. We started to take some action in 2006. We passed a bill that I was the prime sponsor on to prohibit using prescriber and patient identifiable data to influence the sales or market share of a specific brand, to influence prescribing behavior of a specific doctor and to evaluate sales force performance. We do allow commercial use of a somewhat aggregated data, and in our case, we allowed it on the zip code and specialty level. So you could, as a drug rep, know what an office full of doctors was prescribing, but not what the individual doctors in that practice were doing. We also allowed it for these other kind of non-marketing, non-commercial kinds of areas. There was a lot of opposition in New Hampshire to this bill, and just very briefly, some of it was that physician tracking would save money by making marketing more efficient and knowing which doctors should get samples. The reality that we found, actually, was that it would contribute to increased drug spending. Most of the marketing, if not all of it, is for expensive brand name drugs, not for generics, which are cheaper. And the cost, it's a multi-billion dollar industry, is going to be recaptured and passed on to consumers. I have a constituent who is a drug rep, and he said to me, honestly, if I'm doing my job right, I don't need this data. I can walk into a waiting room, and I can tell if the practice is busy and who should get samples. We also heard that buying doctors' prescribing records actually improves care because sales reps can teach doctors how to use drugs, and it contributes to health research. The reality that we found in New Hampshire was that marketing did not improve care. We didn't believe that sales reps were qualified to teach doctors. We found that older drugs had a better, longer track record and might actually be safer. And we further said, wait a minute, we did not prohibit research with these regulations at all. This was strictly about marketing. We also heard, and I think this is really important, that physician tracking improves safety because it can help with the FDA's programs to warn physicians and other prescribers and the public about problems, safety problems with drugs, and that these warnings should be targeted. The reality is that safety programs have to cast a broader net. And I think the most important part here is that the Food and Drug Administration, which is charged with patient safety in this, has been completely silent on the issue of data mining. We had testimony from the head of our medical society actually saying that he was a psychiatrist and he had received warning letters about toenail fungus drugs. So it was undercutting the contention that all of these warnings are targeted. There is an opt-out program from the American Medical Association that was started around the same time our law went into effect. And it's not a real opt-out program because even if the physician opts out, the drug company still gets the data. It's simply the field-level rep and one level up, so their immediate supervisor. It's a very cumbersome process. You have to have a specific database licensing identifier that I think nobody can remember. And in 3.5 years, only 3% of the nation's doctors have actually opted out of this program. We're not the only state to have enacted a data mining law. Vermont did right after us. They looked at opting in for the licensing process. Maine enacted an opt-out. We were sued immediately in New Hampshire in the federal district court in 2006, and we were overturned. It was ruled an unconstitutional constraint of commercial speech. We appealed it to the First Circuit in Boston in 2008, and we were successful. The original decision was overturned. There were two opinions. Both were that our law is constitutional. The majority opinion was that data mining marketing regulations are not speech. The minority opinion was that it is speech and it's commercial speech, but that the state has a right to regulate it, that it's in our interest. IMS and Verispan asked the Supreme Court to take the case, and they declined to do that. So the law is in effect in New Hampshire, and it has been for a year. Vermont was sued. They won in the district court. They have now been sued that was taken to appeal in the Second Circuit. And those arguments were heard in October of 2009, and they're waiting for a decision. Maine has appealed to the First Circuit based on the decision New Hampshire had. So most of the rulings have been in favor of the states being able to do this. And to the extent that you hear it's not constitutional, I would urge you to look at that more carefully. And I would be happy to answer questions later, Mr. Chairman. Thank you
for your testimony. Mr. Wyckoff, we have about 10 to 15 minutes to go on your on the opponent side. So,
yeah, just one minor point on the academic, on data mining issues. This field not only supported by the coalition, but also the Minnesota Medical Association as well.
Okay, well, thank you. Mr. Chair, I don't know what the plural is of Mr. Chair, but... I'm just going to address really briefly the what I would rather call the independent education for prescribers bill, since academic detailing is something that maybe not everybody would understand what that was. I know this committee does, of course, but we have another expert to testify about that, and I just want to say briefly that this is another piece of the answer to the issues that we've been talking about here, which is to establish an independent program where physicians and other prescribers would basically get education from independent, research-based providers who would be providing them education in the places that they work, just as the drug company detail people do now. And this is very important because physicians are busy people. They need to be kept up to date. As you all know, there are a lot of changes in medications, a lot of new research. It's really important, as was explained before, that we use always the latest research. And this has been done in other places and been shown to be effective. And I'm going to introduce Thomas Snedden, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, who is... the director of the largest and most mature program of this kind in the country, and he's from Pennsylvania, and he will speak about their experience with that program.
Welcome.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody. Appreciate the opportunity to come here and tell you a little bit about Pennsylvania and its academic detailing initiative. Let me put everything in context, of course. Pennsylvania has an extremely large population of citizens who are 65 or older, some 2 million people. A lot of those people need help in paying for their prescription medications, and I don't think there's another state in the country that's done more about that than Pennsylvania. 25 years ago, we started this benefit called PACE. I was given the privilege of being installed as the director, and I've been there ever since. And I can tell you from the very beginning, we were very concerned about the misprescribing, misdispensing, and misuse of prescription medications among the elderly in Pennsylvania, particularly when the state was spending billions of dollars to provide a comprehensive drug benefit for many of these people. I don't think it's any surprise to anybody in this room that misprescribing adventures with drugs in the United States are very common among the elderly. I'm sure many of our parents have had this experience. And it can be fatal. In order to prevent these kinds of misadventures, particularly when the government is involved in providing the benefit, it's important to bring about a collaboration of the physicians and the pharmacists who are responsible for the prescribing and dispensing of these medications. In Pennsylvania, through the PACE program, We've done a great deal about that over the past quarter of a century. Very comprehensive, very aggressive intervention that effectively stops dispensing at the pharmacy if we think the medication is inappropriate for one of our beneficiaries. It's been very effective, and it's been supported by both the industry and by the medical society and the pharmacy community. However, about 6 years ago, we realized that these kinds of interventions were largely leaving out the physician. We were not able to bring the physician into our decision at the point of sale until after the fact. In concert with the Harvard Medical School, we determined that it would be a good idea to identify physicians in Pennsylvania that particularly would benefit from educational interventions that involve people working for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Back in 2005, we launched an initiative that we called the Independent Drug Information Service. Some people call it counter-detailing. Other people call it academic detailing. Call it what you may. It's a very benign, effective way of getting at physicians who have prescribing decisions to make when it comes to people that are very problematic to prescribe for, the elderly in particular. I can tell you after nearly 5 years of running this initiative that physicians in Pennsylvania are very excited about it. And have been very pleased with it. So much so that two developments are very recent that are part of the evolution of this initiative. One is, in addition to providing education on particular drug classes, we are now providing education on particular disease states, like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, dementia, depression, that are aimed at helping us keep people out of nursing homes. This academic detailing initiative has evolved from drug-specific now to trying to keep people out of institutions like nursing homes. Secondly, we will also be launching very soon an online academic detailing initiative that will enable any physician in the state to log on to a state website and take the educational credits that are necessary to complete an academic detailing CME. Bottom line for me today is I can tell you in Pennsylvania, academic detailing is working. I will say too that in terms of the money we spend on it, which is about $1 million a year, we recoup that easily in terms of savings on the drug side. But that's secondary to improving health and well-being. And while we haven't proved that yet, we'll have studies, I'm sure, over the next few years that will give information on that. In the meantime, I've left for the committee a detailed report from the Harvard Medical School on what our experience has been to date. I stand available anytime as a resource to you or your staff to provide further information on the initiative. And thank you for having me.
Okay, we're going to hear from one more of the proponents, then we're going to go to the opponents and come back to any further proponents that we missed.
Yeah.
We've got, there's another Senate committee meeting or two coming up at 3, and we want to hear, obviously, some from both sides. Do you want Dr. McCoy or
right, Mr. Chair,
Witzek?
We have Dr. McCoy, who I think just has a minute, and we really, really
okay.
want the committee
That's
to
fine.
Hear.
Thank you for helping us out here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing me to have the opportunity to speak. As a physician, you know I can get through this in a very short amount of time.
We hope so.
So very briefly, I'm the national chair of the National Physicians Alliance for chair of their health policy committee. And I speak on behalf of myself and not on behalf of the Mayo Clinic, where I do happen to work. I always have to say a disclaimer up front. But really, I think you've heard the critical arguments today in terms of why these bills are important. But from a physician, I think the key things are, one, even small gifts influence providers, and there's plenty of evidence to demonstrate that. The constant messaging and the reminder gifts is what they're called from drug companies alter our perceptions of how to treat diseases. And one quick example, there's been a very good study about what the best hypertensive medication is to use. We know what it is. It was a federally funded trial. It was put out there, and we still don't prescribe those medications because there's no one out there to teach us what those drugs are and when to use them appropriately. And so I think that's one key part of the education is the independent academic detailing program that's been promoted here today. When drug companies want to promote these expensive medications on the market, that one of the tools available to them is to track my exact prescribing habits. And one, as a physician, I find it very offensive that there's someone who's tracking exactly what I do, has that data, and won't tell me that they have this data, won't share that data with me, but will simply use that data in order to find the best ways to alter my practices, sort of by discussing things with me, very subtly bringing up that, oh, I haven't been prescribing this medication, do I have concerns, or those sorts of things. It's sort of behind the back, and it's frankly very offensive to me, but also increases the cost and of their marketing techniques. But lastly, I think the most important thing to recognize as a provider is, rather than the gifts and the gizmos and the edusale lectures and the laser-focused marketing based on the last 50 prescriptions that I wrote, what I want as a provider is the best medications for my patients. The pharmaceutical companies spend $12 billion on detailing to physicians. The evidence out there shows it costs about $500 million to $2 billion to develop a new drug. So if the pharmaceutical companies spent that $12 billion that they do trying to convince me to use their medications and actually research new medications, I'd have a dozen new drugs a year. A dozen new drugs a year to prescribe to my patients to help cure their diseases and remove their suffering. As a provider, that's what I want, not gifts and gizmos and gadgets. So with that, I think I encourage you to listen to the arguments, and I want to turn it over to him.
Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you.
Identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Kim Woodstack, and I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm actually here today to put a face on why the bills before you are important to discuss. On August 6, 2003, I became a widow. My husband of almost 10 years, Woody, was given a diet of Zoloft-induced suicide at age 37. He was not depressed, nor did he have a history of depression or any other mental illness. He died after taking the drug a total of 5 weeks, with the dosage being doubled right before his death. He was given the antidepressant from his general physician for insomnia. Woody loved life. He was compassionate, but to me, he was my husband and my best friend, the one I was going to grow old and have a family with. Woody had a successful career in sales and just had started his dream job as vice president of sales with a startup company a couple months prior. And with this excitement came he was having trouble sleeping, so which is not uncommon for an entrepreneur with starting their own business. So on June 30th, 2003, Woody went to see his family doctor, and after a five-minute consultation, was given Zoloft, an antidepressant for insomnia. This was the first time he'd ever gone to the doctor for this sort of issue. The three-week Pfizer-supplied sample pack that Woody came home with automatically doubled the dose after week one, and no cautionary warning was given to him or me about the need to be closely monitored when first going on these drugs or dosages change. Within days, Woody experienced every side effect that he was told about, including akathisia, which is a neurologically condition that causes severe agitation and internal restlessness. Shortly before his death, Woody came home and dropped his bag at the back door, sat on the floor, and had his hands around his head. It told me his head was outside his body looking in. His doctor told him to give it 4 to 6 weeks to kick in, which is what he was told. 2 weeks later, Woody, a total of 5 weeks on the drug, Woody was found hanging from the rafters of our garage by my dad. We've tried so many times during this, after why Woody suddenly went from sleeplessness to having all these new problems. We were unaware and unwarned that Zoloft, the drug that is touted and sold to help, actually was causing him harm. We only knew what we only wish we knew then what we know now. It wasn't Woody's head, it was the drug. For the right person, these drugs, and with the right diagnosis, the right doctor, the right warnings and monitoring, they may help.
but without non-biased information and warnings, these drugs, in fact, all drugs carry, could carry fatal side effects. While struggling to cope with this loss, I've decided to make it my mission to make sure that what happened to our family doesn't happen to others. So why do I come here? I think, you know, since Woody has died, here's how I think it relates. Woody was given a 3-week sample pack by his Azola, by his GP. Insomnia is a off-label use, and he was given samples. I now know a great deal of the information that the doctors get actually come from the drug company representatives. Drug reps visit the offices to discuss the attributes of the drugs and oftentimes leave samples. Between 60 to 80% of all antidepressant prescriptions are written after a quick consultation by usually by a general practitioner or family doctor who may or may not know the significance of these side effects. In my research, you know, the FDA has known about these drug companies since 1991 when Prozac, they had hearings on Prozac and suicide. Somehow the issue was swept under the rug, and drug companies instructed their sales reps to downplay or not to tell the general physicians about this. I've worked in advertising and marketing for years and understand marketing. Drug reps are marketers. Drug companies hire the very best MBAs from the best schools to sell their products. They use marketing tactics that work, such as the data mining we've heard about. Prescription drugs are not the same as cars, drugs, or cars, cereal, if you're going to drink Coke or Pepsi. From a consumer perspective, educating doctors about new drugs should not be left to the marketers. Doctors need non-biased information, and they need all research available to know what the risks are of what they're prescribing. The independent detailing program proposed by legislation would help deliver non-biased, research-based information in the hands of doctors and clinics. You know, patients deserve more, families deserve more. We trust that our healthcare providers are giving us the best healthcare information. Nothing should come between me and my doctor, and certainly not the pharmaceutical companies. I actually don't blame Woody's doctor for what happened. I believe he was a victim of the system that is heavily influenced by pharmaceutical companies and the millions of dollars that they use to promote their drugs. But I do urge you to reduce the conflicts of interest that exist between doctors and pharmaceutical companies here in Minnesota. We need to put the trust back into the system. And I believe Woody's death was preventable, and I don't want what happened to my family to happen to yours. So thank you for having me here today.
Good. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll move on to the opponents of these bills. Our first name is, my agenda, my sheet is Kathy Betts, VP of Government Relations, Walters. Walters Chloe.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today.
Where are you from, and are you spending money in Minnesota?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I passed that test. I'm with Walters Kluwer Health. We may not be a name that you recognize, but we may not be may not have a name that you recognize, but we do have a significant business interest here in Minnesota. We employ 1,300 fine individuals in the St. Cloud area and 130 in Minneapolis. With me today are representatives from another data vendor company. What I would like to do, Mr. Chairman, if I may, just give you go over the high points of our testimony in the interest of time. My counterparts at IMS Health, who have offered to testify and speak to this issue too, can follow me if that's all right with you. We do have some material that we'd like distributed. Here it comes. Thank you. As I said, Mr. Chairman, I'm here on behalf of Walters Kluwer Health. We're a worldwide publishing company. We publish in the area of tax, accounting, legal, and health. One product that we do provide is prescription data information that's used by the pharmaceutical industry, by the United States government, and by the medical community and academia. I'd like to just make a few points, if I can, on the data mining bill, HF 491. First of all, there's been some allegations that patient privacy is somehow compromised under this, the use of prescription data. Protecting patient privacy in today's digital age is not only possible, but it's necessary. But what's been missing from the comments so far is that federal law provides strong protection of personal health information through the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. That's the federal patient privacy law. We at Walters Kluwer believe in and abide by the strict federal and state laws that prohibit the improper use or disclosure of patients' health information. Our own policies and practices to protect patient privacy include multiple encryption techniques and safeguards, so no data in no way allows identification of patients. In fact, we've collected, aggregated, analyzed approximately 3 billion, that's with a B, prescription transactions annually over the past 20 years and without one single HIPAA breach or violation. Second point I'd like to make is that everyone's concerned with about costs. Even the supporters of this legislation are worried about costs. We understand your desire to manage and control costs. This measure today, though, is not likely to cut costs at all. There's been no evidence to suggest that restricting the use of this kind of information will reduce costs at all. The assertions that have been made have no basis in data or studies, and market analyses suggest exactly the opposite. You heard Congresswoman Rosenwald discuss the data mining law that's in place in New Hampshire. That law has been in place for almost a year now. It was in place for 9 months in between 2006 and 2007, and yet we have not heard any evidence to suggest that law has indeed saved any costs for the state at all, or that there's been any impact on the state's prescribing drug costs. You've heard testimony already on how the data is used by the pharmaceutical industry. It is used to target physicians. Pharmaceutical companies want to know exactly who to go meet to educate them on their products. In the absence of this kind of information, pharmaceutical firms will either have to increase the number of sales reps they're using or broaden their outreach to doctors who may not have any interest in their products at all. So it helps target their message, and in that respect, decreases cost. On another point about cost, supporters of the bill maintain that the use of the data encourages doctors to prescribe more expensive brand name drugs. But actually, generic dispensing has grown by leaps and bounds over the last couple of years. In fact, in Minnesota, the dispensing rate for generics is now almost at 80%. So given these trends, it's difficult to make any credible argument about how the use of these data actually drive up costs to the system. Now, because we're very concerned today about jobs and competitiveness with this committee, I'd like to acknowledge that Minnesota has invested millions of taxpayer dollars to attract incubator-type biotech and biopharmaceutical firms into your state. Data restriction measures like the one under consideration today are totally inconsistent with that initiative. Members of small biopharmaceutical companies don't have a lot of money to spend on marketing, so they use prescriber identifiable data to know exactly who to target for to educate them on their products. You will hear testimony from members of the bioscience industry today from Minnesota that this, the use of this data allows them a more efficient process for bringing medical innovation to patients. So restricting the use of this data raises barriers to entry and actually cripples these companies' ability to compete. Finally, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the use of this data for public health and safety is very important. Prescribing information is used not only by, as I said before, not only by the pharmaceutical industry, and biotech and medical device companies, but also providers, government agencies, the Food and Drug Administration, Department of Defense, Drug Enforcement Administration, the Centers for Disease Control, academia and researchers. These data are used to monitor and manage the safety of medications, conduct clinical trials, implement drug recalls, rapidly communicate information to doctors about innovative new treatments, and to conduct public health studies. Commercial databases like those offered by Walters Kluwer and IMS Health are the only comprehensive sources of prescribing information that can be used for a variety of applications. But frankly, use of this data would not be possible without the commercial use to sustain it. So finally, Mr. Chairman, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today. We firmly believe that the public good of Minnesota is best served by evidence-based medicine, improved transparency in the system, and continued responsible use of prescriber identifiable information. We appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today and submit our comments, and respectfully request that you reject this measure outright.
Thank you. The other gentleman wish to?
Yes. Thank you very much. Chairman Atkins, Chairman Metzen, thank you very much, members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you. It occurs to me on many occasions like this that...
Tell us your name again.
My name is Randy Frankel. I'm the Vice President of External Affairs for IMS Health.
Thank you, Randy.
We are a health information company. We've been in business for over 50 years. We now collect information, all of it anonymous information, meaning it's stripped of any patient identity before it ever reaches our walls. And we do that type of business in over 100 countries around the world. And we are, if you will, a currency used to compare and contrast quality of care, utilization patterns, different plan designs to control costs. I myself have spoken at meetings to contrast Australia with England and France and the United States in terms of managed care. All of this done with data that has no patient identity associated with it. Sorry to stress this point, but I think it's really critical that you understand. This is not about patient privacy. There are no missing laptop computers. There are no breaches that people are coming to us with. The anonymous data we use are also being compiled by HHS to create their master outcomes research studies. They link patients across different sites of care, because otherwise, how would you know if you start a patient on two different procedures? What that does in terms of how many doctors they see, how many lab tests, how many hospitalizations they have, how many drugs they take, when they, you know, how long they live. All of these things are basic outcome studies, and they can be done by linking an encrypted identifier that in itself has been doubly encrypted, so we don't know the patient, and we don't need the patient, and we don't want the patient name. If we in some way undermine that confidence, we're not in business anymore. We're very clear about that and have about the highest standards there are in terms of managing patient identity. If there's an old woman in a rural area in New Hampshire, we wouldn't report on anything less than a 20,000 person population. And so we wouldn't give that information. We'd have to aggregate up and up and up until there are so many people that could not be identified. And we have those procedures in place. We constantly upgrade them. And we will work with HHS this year
to improve upon that. So I'd like to say and debate that at any time anyone wants to, that this is not about privacy. If it's about cost, then we have another issue. Because while it may seem logical on the surface, and certainly almost a comfortable idea to ban the use of these data, the problem is that these data do a lot of good. These data are used probably to reduce costs by PBMs, by managed care organizations. When people talk about academic detailing and they say we need to go to those doctors who are high prescribers, what kind of data do you think they're using to find these people? In the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, they're using our data to find high prescribers and to educate. These data are very neutral and can be used to manage costs, to be safety, quality, and if you eliminate it for these purposes, it goes away for all purposes. And for those people who think the government can do it, today, if you want government data, it's 3 years old when it arrives. Imagine trying to manage your blood pressure on a test done 3 years ago. Now, that's the state of the art. When it gets down to some of the other aspects, and I'll very quickly go through this, let's look at some actual numbers. I'm sorry it's a distance away, but I'll try and show you what I'm pointing to. This orange line going upward are the number of representatives in the country using our data from a period from 1999 to 2008. Clearly going up because there are more representatives over this period of time. This line is the rate of growth of pharmaceutical spending in dollars during the same period of time. Use of our data goes up, rate of growth goes down. Now, please allow me a little humor. If we were so directly responsible for this, you should be paying us to sell it. Now, you might say it's not really all drugs I'm worried about, it's only new drugs. During approximately the same period of time, generic utilization has been going up to a point where it's over 70% nationwide, and the use of drugs, new drugs, that are on the market less than 3 years, those are the ones where all the promotional dollars are going, have gone down from 5% to about 1% of total prescribing. More use of the data, rate of growth going down, use of generics going up, use of new drugs going down. I don't take credit, we don't take credit for that. But what it is that the managed care system in this country has evolved. We went from prior authorization and drug interchange and formularies to what are now tiered formularies, automatic generic use, and these things are what are getting these utilization numbers in control. What our data do truly is to allow the dissemination of information to physicians for patients to physicians who actually treat these patients. The biotechnology industry. I'll try and give you an example, and one of the things I wanted to point out. In New Hampshire, we had pointed out the fact that based on managed care principles, our own experience, a bill such as this could do patient harm. In a full-week trial, Judge Barbadaro in New Hampshire, this is not about the constitutionality. This is about the efficacy of this approach. The state failed to prove that any reduction in health care costs that may result from a ban of these data can be achieved without compromising patient care. So let me give you an example of something that we've learned about in the last 6 months. Small biotechnology company in Boston, not a ton of people, not a ton of money, and has a new drug that was not picked up by one of the large pharmaceutical companies. It was too small a population. For Lennox-Gastaut disease, it's a rare form of epilepsy in children. They get over 50 seizures a day, and when they do, they drop to the floor. These are the children who go to school wearing football helmets. It leads to mental retardation, often to institutionalization, sometimes surgery on the stem of the brain, vagal nerve stimulation to reduce the number, or a bisection of the hemispheres of the brain. This is not a drug that cures, but these are desperate parents, desperate families, and there are no alternatives. And this drug was rushed through the FDA, knowing that while it had potential for great benefits, it had the potential for great risks. And what they did is they made this company develop a risk management program, which is very tight. They want to know every doctor who prescribes it, every what doses they use. They want it reviewed monthly. They want it reviewed with the FDA. They want to create a virtual community. So if something goes wrong in one patient, every other doctor in the country knows about it instantly. Well, they are doing that. They use our data. They could have gone to all 12,000 neurologists, but they don't all prescribe this, and they couldn't handle that number with this intensity. With our data, they found 1,100 physicians who prescribe for and treat this disorder. Now, it took them 2 to 3 weeks to reach all those doctors, except in the state of New Hampshire, where the data were banned. And they will tell you today that while they think they got them all, it took them about 8 months, and they wouldn't swear that they found them all. Some drugs are good. Some drugs save lives. Some drugs reduce costs. This would be a law that slows them all down. This doesn't discriminate between a good or a bad use. It simply says, I am going to keep everyone ignorant as long as possible for everything. That's not the way to deal with health. The goal would be to let everyone know about opportunities and build upon it constraints based on cost and appropriateness and guidelines. That's not what this does. It's using ignorance as a management tool. We are opposed to it. We think these data have very positive uses you'll hear about. We think it will harm patients. Someone will get harmed. You may not know who they are, and that may make it easier, but someone will be harmed. This is just not the right approach to meeting your goals, which are obviously necessary. All right, thank you for listening.
Welcome. Mr. Buckler, welcome.
Thank you, sir. Chairman Metzen, Chairman Atkins, committee members. My name is Robert Kunkler. I'm the Director of Professional Relations at IMS Health. I'm the company's liaison with the medical community, researchers, hospitals throughout the United States, and I'm one of the people who helped build the prescription databases that we're discussing today. I'm here primarily to talk about the value of provider-identified commercial data to the overall healthcare system. And I want to make one point very, very clear. If commercial applications are outlawed, as 491 would do, these databases will no longer exist for any purpose. Rather than relying on someone else's description of our business, I'd like to briefly describe the IMS prescription database, how we compile it, and why it's critical that we maintain it. And I'd like to also show you some illustrations of some critical uses of our information. As we have since the late 1980s, IMS obtains patient anonymous prescription information from a variety of sources. And it's a large volume of data. As I think Kathy said earlier, it's 3 billion with a B prescriptions out of about slightly less than 4 billion of all the prescriptions that are filled in the United States. It's about a 70% sample size. We use a patented statistical method to project that huge sample size to the universe. And thus we're able to, with great precision, describe the overall prescription pharmaceutical marketplace in the United States. After we obtain the data in-house, we perform quality control checks, we standardize the information, store it, analyze it in-house, and stage it and then publish it to a wide variety of audiences. That includes, of course, the pharmaceutical and the biotech companies who have a commercial interest, but it also involves governmental agencies such as the CDC, the DEA, CMS, and the FDA, who, by the way, FDA is not silent at all on the use of prescription information, as someone earlier had said. They're not silent because they purchase our information, and they require certain uses of it, of the pharmaceutical companies that they know who have it in-house, for safety applications. The information is also used by state agencies, such as Departments of Health and Human Services, attorneys general, as well as physician organizations, researchers, and the investment community. So this is not just a pharma issue, and we're not pharma. We're an information company. Turning raw data into useful information is a very laborious and expensive process, but the output is worth the cost and effort. It costs us scores of millions of dollars per year to do what we do. Our prescription information makes up one of the most accurate, least biased, most universally representative healthcare evidence bases in the world. It captures information across all payers, cash, Medicaid, third party, and across all prescribers. It's the only thing of its kind that is that comprehensive. We've heard a lot of talk about evidence-based medicine. This is the evidence base for prescribing in the United States. Using our prescription data, analysts, researchers, and clinicians can reach insights and make decisions based upon this full picture. As an alternative, if this went away, they pretty much would be relegated to using Medicaid data, which describes maybe 10% of the market and is skewed demographically, or Medicare Part D data, which accounts for about 15% of the market and is also skewed toward an older population. Also, our information is a lot more current than the alternatives, such as government data. And that's due to competitive pressure. Ms. Betts' organization is our competitor. And one of the ways we differentiate ourselves is who gets good information to users of all varieties quickest and most reliably. As Mr. Frankel noted, Medicare and Medicaid data can take well over a year for them to analyze, compile, and make available for this kind of use. By contrast, we have certain reports that are available 1 week after a transaction happens. Not real time, but it's within a week. And one specific example of that, I'd like to point out, it's in the handout that has the map of Minnesota on the cover. This has some interesting snippets of information about... It's a snapshot of the H1N1 flu pandemic as of one particular point of time at the height of the pandemic in Minnesota. The darker colors are the greater use of antiviral drugs within the state of Minnesota. There's a lot more detail behind that, but these aggregates are built, this county-level view, which is for illustrative purposes, is built upon doctor-level information. You don't have the doctor-level information, you can't have this. We're providing this information to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and we provide them a weekly data view at a very low level of geography so that they can help, they can better do surveillance and tracking of the evolution of the flu pandemic. We provide this information to Dr. Laurie Hicks, who's and her team at CDC. She's one of the nation's top epidemiologists. She has characterized this as being a great improvement over the surveillance system that they've had in the past, and it's kind of the canary in the mine shaft, if you will, to help ferret out what might be where the next occurrence of the pandemic might occur. We're also doing work for the CDC on research into geographic variations in antibiotic utilization, which is the last graph or map in that particular grouping. And that's not an isolated incident. I'd like to point out the bibliography, another handout that I gave you, of scores of research applications of IMS's information. These are the projects that have already been used in academic journals, medical journals, peer-reviewed journals. Additionally, our group has 194 additional projects in the queue right now. These are being done by recognizable institutions, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, MIT, Dartmouth, and certainly not to be shortchanged are Minnesota institutions. Mayo Clinic has two ongoing projects with us, and one researcher, Dr. Neelay Shaw, at the Mayo Clinic has submitted a letter in opposition to 491. He's on his own behalf as a researcher, not speaking for Mayo, as a prior speaker had also noted. But Dr. Shaw is doing interesting research with the information. One of the things that he's looking at right now is the exploration of which doctors nationwide and within Minnesota respond more quickly or more slowly to FDA warnings. So that, again, you know who to target with safety information. Another example, Dr. John Finnegan, the dean of the University of Minnesota School of Public Health, is using our information for a National Institutes of Health-backed study on Gardasil, the vaccine for HPV and cervical cancer. He's doing work in that regard to try to determine factors, media factors, that affect and influence the use of Gardasil. I've also provided some additional slides and graphs to show trends within the state of Minnesota. I'd like to point out just a few. One, kind of in the middle of this.
Sure, actually, let me point out something, too. We've got about eight more witnesses in opposition, and we're going to go with exactly what we did to the proponents, and that's the... Well, we'll go to quarter after three, so just keep that in mind.
Michelle,
I'll hate to lose some of our members here, so...
Wrap up in two more minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Some of the bits of knowledge that you can gain from this information. One shows that 77% of all the prescriptions that are filled in the state are in 2009 were filled with generics. I think that number would surprise a lot of people. If this information is used to drive the sale of branded pharmaceuticals rather than generics, somebody's doing a pretty bad job if 77% of all the prescriptions are currently filled with generics. And you can note that the trend line, it's a lot higher in Minnesota than it is in surrounding states, and it's much higher than national norm. One additional thing in this same grouping I'd like to point out, kind of a final note. It's been said by some of the proponents of data bans, all you need to know is a prescriber's specialty, and you could target marketing appropriately given that bit of information. There is some information in here about HIV prescribing within the state of Minnesota. Last year, 23,000 plus individuals wrote at least one prescription in the state. Of that number, 482 wrote a prescription for HIV or AIDS. However, 45 individuals, just 45, accounted for 80% of the volume of AIDS treatment in the state. And it's across an interesting variety of specialties. 11 of these individuals were internal medicine docs. 4 of them were family medicine. So if there were a new advance in the treatment of AIDS, you could go to those 45 individuals and have a personal discussion with them, either for whatever reason, because you've got to identify who the right people are who are driving 80% of that therapeutic area. But without this kind of information, how on earth would you know which specific doctors to go to? Out of hundreds of internal medicine docs, you'd never find a needle in the haystack of the 11 appropriate individuals. So, I could go on pointing out that some of the nuances and findings of the data all day. In the interest of time, I'll close. I just strongly urge you to reject HF 491. As I said earlier, if the bill becomes law, this kind of information goes away for all purposes. I would submit that more information, not less, is required to understand and improve our healthcare system. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Howard Feinberg from the Marketing Research Association. And like I said, there's about 7 more to go, so...
Yes, please keep me on time.
More to go, so...
Yes, please keep me on time. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Again, I'm Howard Feinberg. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Marketing Research Association. We represent the survey and opinion research profession, which runs for everything from the political and opinion pollsters that some of you may be well familiar with, the small and large market researchers, government researchers like folks at the Census Bureau and National Center for Health Statistics, academics, nonprofits, large, small, we represent all of them. The key to serving opinion research is the collection of and analysis of opinions, attitudes, behaviors, experiences, and in an aggregate form as opposed to some of what we've been discussing in specifics. Marketing research is not marketing, it is not sales, it is not detailing, it is not influencing. The only influencing that's going on, and I'm going to discuss that, is the influencing of practitioners to participate in a research study. The only influence that we're trying to have, and the only influence that we do have. Currently in Minnesota, marketing research pharmaceutical marketing research is not conducted with practitioners. It's according to the Board of Pharmacy, which takes care of the existing law, cannot be done. Because we require incentives to get physicians to participate in such research. Payments to practitioners to get them to participate we found to be essential. In fact, we actually did a study, because we are researchers, they did a survey research study of the practitioner's viewpoint, figured out that about 92% of GPs, 93% of specialists, indicated that incentives play at least some part in motivating them to participate in a marketing research study. About less than 6% of both signify that they would participate in any market research study absent an incentive. And just in case you're curious, that incentive is, I would imagine, has never been more than that practitioner would receive for doing their job. Just not the same thing. And I'm not here representing the pharmaceutical or medical device manufacturers. My members work with or for those companies, do research on their behalf. These incentives and payments to physicians and practitioners are indirect, and the practitioners are not aware of where those payments come from. They may be able to suss it out in certain circumstances, but they are not told. In most circumstances, the marketing research company that is conducting the research studies may not always be aware of who's ultimately funding it. There's multiple hands and multiple companies may be involved in the chain of research. In fact, the interviewers, and especially in focus group studies, may have no clue which company originally sponsored this piece of research. To back up real quick, I'm in Minnesota. It's kind of nice for me, despite the weather. I want to point out that I'm a native, was born in Minneapolis, raised in New Brighton, so kind of cool to be here. But again, I'm here because my folks can't do research in Minnesota for the pharmaceutical companies.
For this group.
As written, HF 1641 would expand that to medical device manufacturers. So medical device marketing research with practitioners will not be conducted here. What we found in any state that has required even the most simple aggregate reporting requirements for payments to physicians is that the pharmaceutical medical device manufacturers cut off marketing research with practitioners. So all the research that we've tried to do on whether or not practitioners will still participate in research if there are certain thresholds of reporting that's required is all pretty much irrelevant, because ultimately, if even the most basic reporting requirements, companies say, forget it, we're not going to endure the hassle. So currently, it has been law and in the regulations of the Board of Pharmacy that payments for participation in marketing research for pharmaceutical manufacturers was a prohibited gift. Last week, they determined that they made an error in that. They were actually intended to target slugging, which is what we call sales under the guise of research. In fact, they recognized marketing research as a genuine research project and a substantial service being provided on the part of the practitioner. The problem is that there's still a reporting requirement, we assume, which means that pharmaceutical companies aren't going to become flying back in to do marketing research with practitioners here again. And you can assume, even if, as written, I can't tell you for certain if marketing research studies are, considered a gift or a substantial service under HF 1641, but I can tell you that the impact of this legislation will be that not only will the research not be able to be done with practitioners for pharmaceutical companies, also won't be able to be done for medical device manufacturers. Even an exclusion from a ban still will prevent that research from being conducted. The only way that it can is a definitive exclusion from the reporting and from a ban. The other states that have reporting requirements, Massachusetts is a good one to highlight. They did actually exclude marketing research payments to physicians when they wrote their regulations last year. Realize we're not trying to influence anybody. It is a barrier rather than a conveyance between the sponsoring company and the practitioner who is participating in the research.
Yeah. Hey, I think, let me interrupt you, but I don't know if Senator Salzman and Senator Bonhoeff have got to leave, and if there's anything on your mind right now, or any questions quickly, or, well, you don't have to, but I just thought, I think you have to, yes.
Well, I just want to just thank everyone for being here today. We have a charter school working group committee. But I think that we do need to think about how this impacts Minnesota, given the fact that we are trying to build a bioscience industry. And I think there's very compelling stories on both sides of this issue. But, you know, I think we have to also think about how data is used when new drugs are developed. I was at the U of M at the Bioscience Discovery Building, and we have such great hope for Alzheimer's. Being there the day after my mother-in-law was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, the fact that we could potentially have a drug, and how would we let people know that drug is available? So I just think that we need to do some work, but I think that there's compelling information, so I really appreciate everyone being here today. And
thank
I
you very much.
I apologize, I have to leave.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Both of you, Mr. Chairs. I, too, appreciate everyone who testified today, and I think that what you've done is you've raised some important issues that we're all concerned about. I'm struggling with whether or not the bills before us are the best solution to some of the problems that have been raised, and so I'm hopeful that we'll have a chance to ask more questions and to understand what the ramifications are if, in fact, we were to go forward with these bills. For example, one of the things I remain the most concerned about is the pharmacy-to-consumer advertising. I don't think that as a consumer, I ought to be the decision-maker around what drugs I might get. I expect that my doctors have that information. And so with regard to the bill that talks about the data, I want those pharmaceutical companies to have the best access to the doctors who are treating the concerns. I'm more concerned that they have that access than that they're coming to me telling me what drug I should take. So I think that we have a messed up system when it comes to the relationship between the pharmaceutical companies, the physicians, the hospitals, and the consumers. I am not certain yet that the bills before us are the exact right bills to solve that messed up system, but I trust that throughout the session that we'll have a chance to ask those questions and work on those bills, and I'll have a chance to work with the authors to find out how best to approach it. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you. There's always work to do on these. Continue on. Are you, how are you doing, Mr. Weinberger? You just went down.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to wrap
you.
It up. No problem. I just wanted to mention a couple of reasons why marketing research with practitioners is important. Everything that was mentioned on the pro side, concerns about transparency, marketing research provides that transparency, right, functions as a watchdog on both industry and practitioners, and provides information about what's happening with patients that may not be provided otherwise. It's provided a good bulwark for adverse event reporting. Things that slip through the cracks otherwise can be caught during studies with practitioners, things that they're seeing. Case in point, now there's a lot of work that has to be done to get a drug through FDA approval. Marketing research studies are actually a part of most FDA approval processes. In case of a particular drug developed by a company in California, it was designed to prevent blindness. Found that people that were taking the drug were not getting pretty good effects after it was released out into common usage. Went against everything they found during FDA trials. With some research studies with doctors, they found out that people were not following the proper regimen, taking as much of the drug as they were supposed to on a daily basis. They were making their own decisions about how much to take because it turns out there was an adverse event that wasn't getting reported. It was causing burning sensation in the eyes, which you can imagine would make you not want to take the drug quite so much. So they were able to find this out, take the drug off the market, reformulate it, bring it back, able to prevent that blindness without the costly side effects that prevented people from complying with the regimen they need to follow. Very basic things, simulations for medical devices. It's a very safe way to figure out if doctors know what they're in, surgeons know what they're doing when they're implanting a device or using a device. Role-playing scenarios with prescribers and practitioners, figure out what they're doing well, what they're not doing well. And at its most basic, we're talking about cost control. A pharmaceutical medical device manufacturer spends billions of dollars developing these drugs and devices. And without adequate market research studies and research with practitioners as part of that scope, how will they know where to spend that money? And if they're able to find out in advance that a practitioner is, if practitioners are not interested in drug X, then why go to the trouble of making something for billions of dollars where you're gonna have to get that money back somewhere? And ultimately that comes out from us.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well,
thank you very much for having me.
Mr. Gerhardt? Mr. Steve Anderson? You're on deck. Plus the... Are you guys... What are your names? State your names. Right?
Don Gerhardt.
Yep, I heard of you.
Anderson, good to see you again, Senator.
Oh, this is wonderful. We got three in a row here.
We're going to go really quickly.
They're actually all going to talk at the same time.
I like that. Okay, I'm five.
Also talking at the same time.
Okay.
All right.
That's how we do it in the legislature.
In the House, they do it that way. 20 people are talking at one time.
Thank you, Chairman.
Good to see you.
It's good to see you again, and we appreciate your time. I'm going to go through mine really quickly. But let me say a couple of important things to you. I'm from Minnesota. I spend most of my money here.
Good, we like that, yeah.
My house is double mortgaged in support of a med tech company in the state. I run a trade association that has about 600 companies, so I see what's going on every day. I talk to these guys all the time. I deal very closely with the pharmaceutical industry that we don't have here. We've got a burgeoning pharmaceutical industry that's extremely important because, for instance, last week, a senior VP at Medtronic said their biggest chances for business into the future are the biologics and the medical device combination. We cannot continue to send negative signals. So let me give you a couple more minutes, then these guys are going to pick it up. Minnesota has about 50,000 of these life science jobs. Each one spins out another six. So there's about 300,000 jobs in play. If we continue to throw negative signals consistently, more of those companies are going to build their expansions outstate, and the little guys and medium-sized guys that these two are part of are going to expand elsewhere, or they're going to close up shop, or they're going to move. I'm also on the board of a company that built in South Dakota and not in Minnesota for some of the same things we're talking about today. So I'm talking about real things. I've experienced them. I experience them every day, and it's happening. A big report came out last week from the Science and Technology Committee that was formed by the legislature last year saying we are behind and falling farther behind. We are. So if we consider where we are, what we've got, and how important it is to keep this industry healthy in Minnesota, it is the watchword of the economy in the state. We can't continue to throw negative signals or layer on things that don't need to be layered on in the state. In a state method. So my comments to you are, do not make Minnesota an island. Can't do that because the businesses of today can go elsewhere really easily. Consider Minnesota's future. Talked about the jobs. And so as people that may have talked to you today may work at a state institution, a university or something else, and they're wondering where all their staff is going to, well, it's because there's no more tax support for certain parts of the education system because jobs are disappearing. Don't continue to layer on things that do damage to what we've already got. Extremely important. I've been to Ohio, I've been to Wisconsin, I have been to Washington, I've been to Maryland, I've been to North Carolina, China, Hong Kong, Ireland, and Scotland, and seen what's going on there. We're not competing just with other states, we're competing with other countries, and we're getting our butts kicked. So we cannot continue to layer on things that we're talking about. So consider what's in place before adding new mandates. That's one of the strongest things I want to bring to you. We already have lots of things in place. We have things coming on federally that are going to impact. Don't do patchwork. Do not. It makes us an island immediately and makes us first shot in the turkey shoot. It just literally does. Next is Howard Root. And Vascular Solutions.
Thank you. An add-on to some of this discussion is we had a Minnesota stimulus bill last year that
that would help in some of these areas, and you've got the Angel Investor Initiative and the COPEC for insurance companies. So see, these are all kinds of tools that I think we need in our toolbox to compete with some of these neighboring states.
We absolutely appreciate it. And it seems like a whole number of those are coming together right now. The construction on the University of Minnesota campus, the University of Minnesota Mayo Partnership, et cetera, a lot of which is funded out of legislature, is coming together. The pieces are just starting to assemble. We just can't throw the negative signals that make this industry move away.
We must do more. Okay, gentlemen.
Thank you for the opportunity to spend today. I'm Howard Root. I'm CEO of Vascular Solutions, which is a medical device company based in Maple Grove. I'm also a native Minnesotan, having grown up in St. Anthony Village, and I'm a graduate of the University of Minnesota. In 1997, I became associated with a doctor who had an idea for a new device, so I literally took $300 of my own money and created Vascular Solutions. Over the last 13 years, we've obviously raised a lot more money from venture capitalists and an initial public offering, and we've worked with many physicians to create new medical devices. We currently manufacture and sell over 50 devices used in treating a variety of vascular conditions, ranging from a heart attack to varicose veins. Our sales in 2009 were approximately $70 million. We have 250 employees, all of whom are based in Maple Grove, where we manufacture all of our devices, with the exception of our field sales force, which is located throughout the United States. I want to just take literally 3 minutes and explain how this proposed gift ban legislation would affect vascular solutions. First, the details are very important in this legislation. The disclosure obligations would require us to report, quote, all payments or other compensation paid to practitioners, sponsors of medical conferences, or other educational programs, close quote. We attend over 50 medical meetings each year with a variety of payments made for our exhibit hall space, our sponsorships, and other items. We also provide patient education services at local health fairs, particularly with regard to our varicose vein procedures. In addition, our 90 field sales employees make over 30,000 hospital visits each year, required by the FDA to do training, which includes educational activities. So under the proposed legislation, I would have to have at least 2 full-time equivalents to review all of these payments and expense reports on a weekly basis and file an annual disclosure. And then you would get a form that would say we spent $20,000 for an exhibit hall booth at the American College of Cardiology, something that's completely irrelevant to the healthcare consumer. And since we sell our products in all 50 states, if this legislation were adopted in all 50 states and not uniform, we would require an even larger administrative nightmare. Now, a better approach to the disclosure requirement is a federal legislation, as it is with all of these items discussed here today, a uniform, more tailored, and specific to the industry that you're dealing with. But the Federal Sunshine Act is pending in Congress and accomplishes this. I'm on the board of the MDMA, which is the Medical Device Manufacturers Association. Us and AdvaMed both support this and are lobbying for its passage with Senator Klobuchar and Senator Franken. Now, the other provision of the proposed legislation would make it illegal for Vascular Solutions to provide any, quote, gift to a physician, with the definition of gift taken straight from the statute that prohibits gifts for lobbyists to legislators. So I hope everyone understands that a medical device salesperson is not the same as a lobbyist. We are required by the FDA to train all of our physicians on the use of our devices. During this training, we provide free samples of the device, because I'm sure we all want a doctor to play with the device on a benchtop before they use it in a human body. Sometimes we provide payments to physicians who come in and train our sales force on how to train physicians on our devices, and we do numerous other educational activities. All of these would be prohibited by the gift ban if it was paid to a practitioner under the proposed law. And even more importantly, to improve our products, we interact with many physicians on the design and clinical use. To be prohibited from providing compensation to these medical advisors would severely hamper our product development and really undercut the business strategy that I use to create Vascular Solutions. So finally, and to me what is really the most troubling aspect of this legislation, is the underlying assumption that the medical device industry is corrupting physicians, or as I heard today, that we are literally pollution that needs to be kept a safe distance away. With all due respect, that's wrong for the Minnesota economy, and it's wrong for patient care. Minnesota's medical device industry is a strength that does not need a federal stimulus payment to continue our growth, but we also cannot continue to grow our employment with burdensome state disclosure obligations and restrictions on the way that we develop our products. The product development system has resulted in many breakthrough devices in Minnesota, from the pacemaker, the mechanical heart valve, septal occluder, all of those Minnesota companies working with Minnesota physicians to create a new medical device. And while Vascular Solutions doesn't have that level of product, we do have the same type of physician industry interaction. And one last example. We're currently working with a physician out in California who's used one of our current products to treat a, really save the life of a young woman who is suffering from postpartum pulmonary thromboembolism, which is the leading cause of death of the mother following delivery. The physician is providing advice on how to create a specially tailored version of this product and how to do a training program that any physician could do it across the country. If the proposed legislation were adopted, it would be literally a crime for me to pay that doctor's expenses for a trip to Minnesota to discuss his clinical case with me, or even to buy him dinner at a medical meeting to discuss the case. Now, I don't think that type of interaction should be judged as corruption or as pollution, and certainly should not be prohibited. Thank you.
Thank you. We did talk, by the way. We got. We think we can put together $150 to buy half of our
15 years late. Yeah, you know.
Thank you. My name is Steve Anderson. I'm the president of Acorn Cardiovascular. We are a company developing innovative, novel, minimally invasive therapies for the treatment of heart failure. Heart failure is the only cardiovascular disease in the country. It's increasing in incidence and prevalence. It is the number one Medicare cost in the United States. We have done clinical studies already with five-year follow-up that show that we can cut transplant costs by 40%. So not only efficacious, but cost-effective for the healthcare system. I'm an adjunct professor at St. Thomas. I teach coursework specific to medical device regulation. I'm also on the board of a couple of other companies. One is a public company called ATS, which manufactures products for treatment of valve disease and atrial fibrillation. Acorn is a pre-revenue company. Believe it or not, we have already spent $110 million trying to get through the FDA process. This is very difficult for us. We were approved in Europe in 2000. We are still looking at U.S. approval, not until 2012. We got approved in Europe based upon $25 million. It'll cost us at least $100 million more by the time we get to the end of the road for the U.S. So the message here is that regulation is very expensive. The U.S. has by far the most medical device regulation in the world.
Yeah.
And again, there is no evidence whatsoever that the EU system is less safe than the U.S. system. In fact, we've seen a lot of speakers today comparing the uses of pharmaceuticals in the U.S. compared to other countries. And of course, if the systems in these other countries are not as good as ours, that wouldn't be an apples-to-apples comparison. So I think most people agree that, in fact, the EU system is very effective and is very safe. Higher regulation is higher cost. 7 years ago at Acorn, we had 55 people. Due to the longer time it has taken for us to get through the FDA process, we have had to continually, iteratively lay off people. We now only have 25 people working there instead of 55 people. So that extra regulation directly is affecting our ability to keep people employed and, unfortunately, our ability to do other R&D projects that we feel are even more pressing. Anytime you have a new innovative product, you need to think of it as, you know, cars started with a Model T. You didn't go from a Model T to a Corvette overnight. You had to start, and every time you come out with a new product, you get better and better, and you learn more and more. So we have the other R&D projects that we feel can eventually lead to a Corvette, but you need to have an opportunity to do that. So, in summary, in regard to the transparency regulation, I want to reiterate what Howard has talked about. 50 states with 50 different systems would be an absolute nightmare for our industry. It would cost us a huge amount of money. ATS, in terms of just dealing with a Massachusetts-specific system, has already spent over $200,000. Now, the federal government has a good bill in place. I would go on record as saying that it is imminent that it's going to be passed. It is a bipartisan bill. The right way to go is for a federal bill instead of 50 different state bills. Now, finally, I'd just like to point out that in addition to being a manufacturer, I've also been a regulator. I actually ran a company that regulated products for the European Union in the United States. My son actually is a special needs child with a spina bifida, so we are a heavy healthcare user. So I've been on all sides of this, and I want to reiterate what Don has talked about. and what Howard has talked about. We need to strike the right balance here in terms of protection along with innovation. Thank you.
Some work to do. Okay, thank you. I tell you, times are so tough where I work at. We had a guy come in the other day, want to change for a 50. We made him a partner. All right. Dave Dietrichs.
And then Marjorie Powell.
Powell. Marjorie Powell. On deck.
Hi, Mr. Good Chair. Morning. Mr. Chair.
Afternoon.
Members, thank you for the opportunity to come speak with you today. It feels like old times coming back before both your committees. My name is Dave Dietrichs, and I'm the Director of State Government Affairs for a company called Express Scripts, and I'll keep my testimony very brief. Specifically, we want to talk about some of the unintended consequences of House File 491, the data mining bill. My company is a pharmacy benefits manager, and a 30-second overview, that means that part of your health insurance means you have a prescription drug benefit. So when you go to the doctor and he or she writes you a script, you can go to a pharmacy to get that script filled. We will adjudicate that transaction on behalf of a health insurer, on behalf of a labor union, on behalf of a Fortune 500 company, on behalf of the United States Department of Defense, who's our largest client. And we do that for 75 million Americans. We drive out waste in the healthcare system by utilizing generic drugs, by encouraging people to use mail order pharmacy, by setting up formularies and retail pharmacy networks for people to use. But what I wanted to talk about today was something else that we do, and that's specialty pharmacy. And specialty pharmacy is a special area of pharmacy that revolves around treating patients with very rare, complex, and chronic diseases. We're talking about people who are affected one in every 10 or 20,000 in the population. A lot of these drugs that treat these folks in specialty pharmacy are developed by single source groups in the life science alley or other biotech industries. It's a very expensive treatment for most of these rare diseases. We're talking anywhere from $500 to $20,000 a month. And we rely on the use of data so that we can treat patients. Now, part of House File 491 allows us to utilize what's called a federal risk management plan when we treat these patients. These drugs are so rare, so expensive, they're only manufactured usually by one source. There's no detailing that's going on by pharmaceutical reps. We're actually working with one company in order to help treat individuals with these rare diseases. And we use the data so that if there is a change in the dosage or the change in the administration or if there is a recall in the drug, that we can notify physicians right away. This literally is a patient safety issue for us. We need to have this data so that we can talk to physicians about how this occurs. And so we find that that's one of the severe unintended consequences of the data mining legislation. So we're very concerned about that. And I guess I'll leave my remarks there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Marjorie Powell, thank you for coming. Get a handout?
Thank you. My name, I do have a handout.
Okay, we've got some helpers here.
Two documents. My name is Marjorie Powell. I'm from PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. I represent the women and the men, including many in Minnesota, who are doing the research to find the new medicines for treatments for patients in the United States. And Senator Metzner, before you ask your question, I'm from Maryland. I'm here in Minnesota for 3 days, and I'm spending money. And one of the tasks that I left my husband to do while I'm here in Minnesota is to write a check to a family member who is buying college textbooks here in the Twin Cities.
That's great.
So not only is the pharma money coming, but some of the personal Powell money is coming to Minnesota week as well.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
And one of my favorite restaurants is in Minnesota.
Give them a plug. What is it?
It's Nosh, and it used to be in Wabasha, and I just moved and I to a city north of Wabasha, and I'm drawing a blank on the name. What?
Okay, sir.
It's on the river, in any event. From the pharma perspective, as I said, I represent the women and the men trying to develop new medicines. From our perspective, the purpose of the research is to treat disease. We think that disease is our enemy and that our obligation is to help find ways to improve treatments and, frankly, to improve patients' access to those treatments. It's important to remember that in the United States, 75 cents out of every healthcare dollar goes to treatments for chronic diseases. So finding ways to treat chronic diseases, high blood pressure, heart conditions, diabetes, high cholesterol, all those kinds of conditions, and finding ways to make sure that patients in fact comply with whatever their treatment regimen is very important. In order to develop new medicines and in order to see that they're used properly, it's important that pharmaceutical companies have interactions with physicians. Physicians conduct the clinical trials. Physicians identify the reasons why a particular medicine is not being used properly by a patient. You heard examples of medicine with a side effect that the developer was not aware of that could then be improved and the medicine would in fact be used by patients. Well, a number of patients with chronic conditions, a third to half of patients with heart disease, don't take their medication as they've been prescribed. Now, that results in higher healthcare costs, but one of the important things for pharmaceutical companies to find out is, why is it that patients are not taking their medications? Is it because of side effect that is particularly the patients find particularly unpleasant? Is it because the patients don't understand how they're supposed to be taking their medication? So consulting with actual practicing doctors becomes important. In addition, because drugs are in fact dangerous products, the reason they're prescription drugs is they can't be used safely without the intervention of a doctor. It's important that the physicians know how to use those products, know when to use them, know when to not use them, which classes of patients should not be prescribed a particular drug. That's important not only for the doctor, but for everybody in the doctor's office. When I'm a patient, if I'm calling my doctor's office with a question, I don't get the doctor. I get somebody else who answers my question or who may talk to the doctor and get back to me. In order to make sure that physicians know how to use products, you need to have somebody who understands that product, who talks to the physician. That's the role of the pharmaceutical representative. But those representatives are very closely monitored. The FDA has an entire division that does nothing but review the materials that pharmaceutical companies will be using with physicians, who they go out and actually talk to physicians and ask about the behaviors of pharmaceutical representatives. They go to conferences and pretend to be physicians. In fact, many of them are physicians. And they talk to the representatives staffing those exhibit booths. And if the pharmaceutical representative is presenting inaccurate information, incorrect information, information about an off-label use, the pharmaceutical company gets a letter from the FDA warning them. And I can tell you from talking with the lawyers in my companies that pharmaceutical representatives who misrepresent information to doctors are in fact disciplined up to and including termination. With that activity is an important part of what pharmaceutical companies do after they've developed and once they are marketing drugs. That's the basis for the relationship between pharmaceutical companies and doctors. But pharma recognizes that there have been abuses. There are stories of inappropriate behavior, inappropriate gifts to physicians. So we've had a code of interaction with healthcare professionals for a number of years. We revised this code last year, and one of the things we said was no more reminder items, no more pens, no more coffee mugs. In fact, this pen that I'm using as an example is from an insurance company. About half the pens in my purse are from insurance companies. The other half are from hotels. But gifts are in fact prohibited. But when I am asking the doctor to tell me why it is that young patients have trouble using my asthma inhaler, and I'm paying that doctor for his time to tell me, or that nurse practitioner who's been training the 5 and 6 year olds in how to use my inhaler, that's not providing a gift. That's making a consulting payment to that doctor for that doctor's expertise or that nurse practitioner's expertise. Under the terms of these bills, some of that would be banned. In one bill, there would be the state would be setting essentially the limit that I, as a pharmaceutical company, could pay a doctor or a nurse practitioner for providing that kind of consulting service for me.
Ms. Paul, we're going to go another 5 minutes or so.
I actually just have two more points to make, okay, if I can, very quickly. These bills don't do anything to improve access to health care for people in Minnesota. They don't do anything to improve the quality of care in Minnesota, and they don't do anything to improve the treatments that are available for patients in Minnesota. In fact, they may make it more difficult for physicians within Minnesota to actually participate in clinical trials. As of 2008, there were something like 2,000 clinical trials that had an association with Minnesota. In Rochester, at the moment, there are more than 700 clinical trials enrolling patients that are associated with physicians in Rochester. These bills won't improve the quality of clinical trials or the quality of care. And we urge you to, when they come before the committees, to vote no on all these bills.
Hey,
thank you for your time.
We were, Representative Atkins and I were talking earlier about going from 1 to 3, but this has been pretty good discussion, so we're going to go to another 5-6 minutes and appreciate everybody that's been here and talking and the discussion. But now we hear from Representative Anderson. Do you have a question? Senator Representative Davids, did you have a comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If someone could answer, someone mentioned that one of the biggest users of this data that we're trying to outlaw is the state of Minnesota. If the state of Minnesota would not get this data under the current form, how would they get it? All right, then I've got a follow-up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Lieberman.
Thank you for that question. You know, one of the things that's been said here a lot is that the bill, the data mining bill, would prevent this data from being collected or used for other purposes. And I think that's really a straw man argument. This bill limits the restriction to using that data for marketing purposes. It does not limit it from being used for all other purposes. So I think that that's, you know, it's a, as I say, it's a straw man argument. They're complaining about something the bill doesn't do.
But with a representative labor, without a commercial user that pays for the data to be assembled, who would be paying for it then? Would I assume government would be asked, or government or academia would be asked to pick up the tab to have the data accumulated? Is that the point of the bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know. Yeah, I actually am rather curious.
You could come up with make these just get bullet answers.
Yeah, I'm rather curious about that assertion. I don't know what the cost is of gathering this data and all of the who all they sell it to, but certainly the pharmaceutical industry is one big user of it. But it would not, the bill does not limit the use of the data for all kinds of purposes, research purposes, selling it to other people, using it for safety, to recalls. But also, they're not the only people that collect this kind of data. As I understand it, this data is collected, maybe some of my testifiers could help me, but it's collected by Medicaid and, you know, and others. I don't think that this is the only place that it is collected.
Representative Davids, did you have a
I'd like to hear from the gentleman that knows.
You had mentioned, Mr. Chairman, sure. And Representative, you had mentioned Minnesota. And I don't think, perhaps if I said that, or we said it, we misspoke. Some of the largest users of these is the U.S. government. states do use these data, and quite a number of them have been offered the data for a variety of other purposes. But none of these people, not academics, not government, not the medical community, pay more than a few cents on the dollar of what it actually costs to do. We operate at a loss. So if you were to eliminate the commercial users of these data, you'd be dealing with perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars of expense with no way of gaining reimbursement. Our point there is it is unlikely we would be able to afford to talk to shareholders about a multi-million dollar investment. We're not selling it because we don't break even with academics and government and other entities.
Just thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two other points. I am very disappointed in Big Pharma for selling out in the national health care bill for 80 billion pieces of silver. And also, I was also thinking about New Hampshire. I visited New Hampshire. It's a beautiful state with the Green Mountains. And their motto is live free or die. I'm very surprised that they're the only state that is putting on unnecessary government regulation and taking away the rights of citizens and small business. I find that curious.
Okay, any Tomasoni.
Because, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that I've formed an opinion on these bills just yet. That doesn't mean you should all be knocking on my doors, but
that's why you should form an opinion early, sir.
I did find it very curious, though, given the gridlock in Washington on health care and what's going on out there, that somebody would say that we should let Washington take care of this, because I don't think they can pass anything out there. So I'm not sure that. I thought that was a very curious statement myself.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the issue of data bans was considered as part of health care reform. The House decided it was too complex. Obviously, the unintended consequences were brought up, and they put it to study. The Senate basically decided not to proceed because they actually use these data for things like comparative effectiveness, pay for performance could not be done if you don't know what physician you're talking to, and a number of other things that have to do with performance metrics, quality metrics, and performance-based payments. All of those things depend on having physician-level data, and these other data sources tend to be multi-years old before you see them. So if you need something timely enough so that when a doctor performs in their function or in their practice, and you want to feed back to them over a period of weeks or months on how they're doing, there is no government data available today to do that. It doesn't mean it couldn't be done, but then government would have to invest those hundreds of millions of dollars, and I don't know of anyone who's got that in their budget.
Okay. Representative Cleveland, Representative Rosenwald, I assume, had to head out, but do you happen to know if they're the only ones that, and granted it's on and off, but the only ones that have had that law in place, I think, since 2006. Then it was off for a while, now it's been back on. What's been the impact on the cost of drugs in New Hampshire, if you know, or if you can find out?
Right, Mr. Chair, I wish she was here to answer the question. I think that I think she had said that the data's not in yet on that. But, you know, it has been only a year that it's really been in effect. And because it was, I think it was in effect for 9 months and then, you know, suspended, and then it's been in effect for years. So I don't think they have the data in yet on that.
Okay. And I didn't see anything in her presentation. I'm just curious, and maybe some of these folks can accumulate some data. And okay. Let us.
I may add, Mr. Chairman, that in Vermont they testified it might take as long as 5 years to know whether this law works. And I would argue that anything that takes 5 years to be measured probably doesn't have much of an impact.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I think on behalf of all of us, when we initially talked about doing it, the first we heard of it was last year during session. We had some bills come up. And unfortunately, the committee process that we have sometimes doesn't allow for hearings like this. So it was a very intriguing and, I think, enlightening opportunity for all of us to hear from both sides at some length. And I really appreciate everybody that came out for it.
Mr. Chairman,
beginning probably of a conversation, Representative David.
Are the Green Mountains in Vermont or New Hampshire?
Yes, they are.
Vermont. I apologize for the record. I stand corrected.
But thank you to members of the committee as well for, I think we're down to just reps, so no offense to the Senate.
Oh, yes.
He's not paying any attention, though.
No, you're here.
So thank you all for coming in during the interim, and we look forward to more discussion of the issue.
Thank you. It is adjourned.